5, would you please note that represent Crook's excuse. There are seven items on the agenda. It's the intent to go through them in order for the sake of the audience. The last two items are pretty complex, so we may be spending a little bit more time on those. Ms. McGlashan.
Senator Devlin.
Okay, we'll go to the
Chair,
agency first.
The agency is ready to come up and present on their items.
I've just been referring to her. I don't get much chance to talk to her anymore, and soon she's going to go over to the dark side, over to Ben.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brett West, Assistant Superintendent for the Department of Education, and we're here to request a special purpose appropriation for early childhood, special ed, early intervention caseloads, and Nancy Latini will make the presentation for us.
Please proceed.
Good morning. Chair Devlin, members of the committee, my name is Nancy Latini. I'm the Assistant Superintendent for the Office of Student Learning and Partnerships. I'm here today, as Brett said, to provide you with a status report on the caseload for early intervention, early childhood special education. This report is in response to the budget note from the 2005 legislative session. The budget note regarding special caseload for early childhood special education requires that the department report on the status of the programs, specifically with information regarding the number of eligible children served, the actual caseload growth to date, the projected caseload for the remainder of the biennium, and the amount of additional federal funding, including the Individuals with Disabilities Education funding and Medicaid funding. There are really two elements to the early childhood program in special education. The early childhood special education program serves young children ages 3 to 5 or upon entering kindergarten, which is usually age 5. This is a required program by the federal government. The early intervention program serves children birthed through 2 years of age, and this is a required program under state law. Both programs are funded by federal and state funds. But unlike the school-age special education program, the early intervention program, the program from birth to 2, the programs are required under state direction to bill for Medicaid. But in Oregon, we have a seamless early childhood special education program where we serve all of our children birth through 5 without breaking them out because of age like the federal government does, and therefore our entire program is required to fund for Medicaid funding. The purpose of the early childhood special ed program is to attend to the special needs of children with disabilities as early as possible to either prevent the long-term negative educational effects or to determine what specialized supports and services these children need when they enter school-age programs. It's the intent of the programs to reach families and teach them how to address those disabilities to avoid costly services later or to deter the negative effects, as I said, of the disability on formal educational experiences and to determine what learning supports are needed for these very young children once they enter school and even in some cases to avoid totally any further specialized services when they enter school. The 2005 legislative session included a set-aside special purpose appropriation to be used for costs related to increase in caseload. And actually, the 2003 legislative session included a similar set-aside appropriation. But during that period of time, we experienced a very small, unusual small growth, and therefore the department could not justify and we did not request those funds during that biennium. We're seeing a much different trend in the growth at this point since last spring. The caseload since April of 2004 has grown substantially, as shown in the chart that was in your letter. I have extra charts if you need them. Currently, as of September of 2005, there's a total of 536 more children in the program than a year ago in September of 2004. In March of 2005, the caseload had a total of 740 more eligible children than the year before in March 2004. And in August of 2005, the caseload showed 745 more eligible children than in August of 2004. So the growth has been consistent over this time period. We usually expect a decrease in September of each year, as this is the time that many children reach the kindergarten or school age and are transitioned into kindergarten, and they're therefore eligible for the early childhood program. The caseload for September of 2005 showed an 8.5% increase compared to the caseload of September of 2004. And in October of 2005, we just got these numbers a week ago, the caseload showed continued increase, indicating that in October of 2005, the caseload had 503 more children than when we compared it to the October of 2004 caseload. So both September and October showed a growth of about 500 more children in the same months of last year, overall representing about a 5% increase in the program. We expect this growth to continue. One of the reasons we expect it to continue is that there's a new and renewed focus on very young children and a much better understanding of the importance of reaching children at a very young age to prevent problems later on in school. And with that continued growth, the department and our service providers are finding it quite difficult to provide and run adequate programs at the recommended allocation for the biennium. At this time, the department is asking for the full set-aside appropriation to assure services will continue with quality staff and quality programs as the children are located and identified as needing services. There is no indication that federal funds are going to increase, especially considering the needs of the hurricane victims and other national disasters right now. The Medicaid revenue, with all of its changes, is never going to reimburse to a substantial level to support any program. The continued attention to child find is going to remain constant, especially as Oregon continues to get newcomers in and our low socioeconomic situation remains that way. There's also, under the reauthorized Individuals Education Act of 2004, a renewed focus on locating and serving eligible young children prior to the start of formal schooling. And again, this is an emphasis in the federal government on avoiding those costly services later on. Plans to demonstrate how the state, including Oregon, is going to address this child find as part of a required submission that we will be sending to the U.S. Department of Education in December. So we do see that the trend will continue. I'm happy to respond to any questions that you might have.
Are there any questions? Yes, Senator Schrader.
What is the current performance outcome for this particular program for the department?
Chair Devlin, Senator Schrader, current performance outcomes are based on the IEP goals and objectives and following kids to see how they're doing in school.
I'm sorry, I meant the actual number. In other words, what quantified result are we expecting as a result of this program in state government?
Of numbers of children being served? Or
no, I don't want outputs. Okay. I'm talking about, you know, because we are serving X number of these children, these children are more ready to learn than those that are not in the program. And
I understand, Chair Devlin, Senator Schrader. One of the things that we do every other year is the Kindergarten Survey Readiness Survey. Our children that have received special education services are separated out like other categories, and they are showing that they're ready, they're more ready every year, better ready to attend kindergarten.
Could I make a request, Mr. Chair?
I would like to see how this performance outcome is going to be improved. Because we're enrolling more children, I would like to know quantifiably, just a rough estimate on your part, you know, since we're doing performance-based budgeting these days, you know, if we put money into the program, regardless of the mandates or not, that we're going to be seeing some better results, more children in our state ready to learn. That would be a powerful statement about the value of the program, which I think is a good program.
An additional piece of information you'd be interested in knowing is we've done two things this last year. We've developed a statewide early childhood observational assessment. We're training all of our early childhood teachers, not just those in special education, but in Head Start in Oregon, pre-kindergarten, and Even Start, any programs that we have, to conduct this. We did a pilot last year of about 500 children, and we're doing a field test this year. We also now have student identifiers similar to the school-age children, so we'll be able to follow these kids into school and see how they're doing. But you'll also be able to see the outcomes. We can, by next biennium, show you at least the results of the field test compared to the pilot.
That's outstanding. Second question?
Yes.
Does someone else
have? Yes.
Go ahead. Why the dramatic increase? So certainly, it's very, very well documented. Great job in documenting that. It's a big difference from just a couple of years ago. Why the big increase in students?
Chair Devlin, Senator Schrader, that's a very good question. We looked really hard at the reasons why there was such a low caseload growth in the last year or so, and I do believe part of it had to do with the people being a little complacent over actually doing completing child find, looking into the communities, making sure doctors understood. We put an active action plan into place, making sure that we actually could now, because we also have a an electronic way of monitoring the caseloads on a monthly basis, can look at the geographic areas and see where there might be problems, go into that area and talk to service providers about, are they making sure that the people are aware that there are referrals, are there kids out there? We knew the kids were there, and it was just that we were not actually looking for them. And so for them to understand, the service providers, that the legal obligation was to find these children, and also to understand how we can better prepare kids for school and avoid costs later on in school if we get these kids early on.
Last question, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
And this might be for staff, either BAM or for LFO. Notice that this is part of it's at least a federally mandated program. The other is our state aspect. This $4 million or $4.9 is certainly appropriate, I think, at this time, given the documentation. I'm a little worried about the $12 million that may be coming down the line, and wondered how we might be dealing with that, seeing as that we only have a $30 million general purpose emergency fund. And very concerned, despite the good work, I'm very concerned about other needs in the next 18 months.
I think that's understood. And I didn't read that as an in addition. Is it an in addition to the 4.9? Is the 12 including the 4.9? Ms. Ames.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the 12 is a total need. And these are preliminary estimates, but my sense is it will be more in that ballpark than it will be in the 4.9. We did not recommend additional funding at this point for that very concern, that there just isn't the money in the e-fund. Our thought was, as we get more actual caseload data, maybe next spring, the agency could come back, ask for maybe a small amount if that seemed warranted. And there would also be the option, once we were back in session, to report back in early on during the session with relatively final caseload numbers, and a request for potentially funding part of that. Now, of course, as we get towards the end of the second year, the dollars have much more limited effect because you only have a few months left in the school year, but it may still be that another $1 million or something at that point would be very useful.
But just a comment, Mr. Chair, that I'm just a little concerned about our emergency fund. Even $7 million more is a big dent in a $30 million emergency fund, and this is a mandated program, so we have to be very careful with a lot of other requests that we're going to be receiving today and in the future.
You concluded?
Thank you very much.
Yes. Representative Krupp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What are you spending per child in the students that are enrolled today, total funds, state, federal, everything all combined?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, currently, if we do get the e-board reservation, we'll be spending $6,974 per caseload, assuming that the federal funds stay at the level we project them to be.
Any follow-up?
Yes.
Some simple mathematics. It says here that you are intending that caseload growth will increase 5%. 0405, 8,560 children. You're expecting to serve close to 9,000 in 0506. That's an addition roughly of 460 kids divided into $4.89 million. They come up with about $11,120 per child. Explain that discrepancy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, the numbers that I gave you would be based on our anticipated caseload of 18,007 kids over the entire biennium and a total revenues of $125.6 million from all funding sources. So the numbers you are using, I think, are a little more isolated than taking a look at the entire caseload and all revenues. So I think the numbers we have are based on the entire amount we have available.
Okay, Mr. Chair, follow
up. Yes.
All right. So you're asking for $4.9 million. You divide that by the number of kids, and it comes out almost twice as much as you're spending now. Not quite. Maybe 47-48%. Explain why. Why are these kids more expensive?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, these kids aren't more expensive. What we're taking a look at is the overall cost for all of the kids who we expect to serve. The $4.9 million is the amount that was reserved in the emergency fund for any caseload growth we might get. When we built our current service level calculation, we actually thought that the cost per child would be $7,493. But because the caseload growth has been greater, it has driven down the cost to the $6,974. So what I think you're seeing is an interplay of one portion of the funding that we're asking for based on the increased number of students, but even so, we're at a lower level than the essential budget level would have had us funded at.
Mr. Chairman, I guess what I'd like to see is I'd like to see a breakdown of how you intend to spend the $4.893 million, if it is reserved for caseload growth, and caseload growth is roughly what is noted here in your document. I'm having difficulty. What am I missing here? Someone help me. I'm just a farmer. I'm just adding up the numbers.
Ms. Ames, do you want?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, I think what's noted in the document is just the caseload in the first year, 460-ish. But remember, you're going to have to pay for those increased kids for the first year. You'll have to pay for those same kids for the second year, and then there'll be another 400 and some in addition to that in the second year. So it's 2 years of 400 and 1 year of another 400 in essence.
Okay, so Mr. Chair, the question I would ask is why are we giving you all the money now? Shouldn't we hold it and wait? Some of it, pay for the 460 now and wait until the next 400 come online at the next appropriate e-board meeting to see where your growth figures, if they're going to stay in line with your projections, and make those adjustments now. And we got a $52 million hole staring us in the face from DHS. And I think we probably ought to be about as frugal as we can be. So I'm okay. Mr. Chair, I guess that's a question for staff more than anything else.
Okay. Ms. McGlashan,
Mr. Chair, I just point out that this $4.9 million for caseload growth was based on the assumptions that were built in the governor's recommended budget, and that was about 2% growth per year. And you're already looking at 5% growth per year. And again, we're calculating that the total need for the biennium for additional caseload is around $12 million. So the $4.9 million is just to address a portion of that. You could, you know, rationalize that that is just for the first year, given the caseload growth that we're expecting now. So my recommendation is that you give them the full special purpose appropriation, because, in fact, it looks like it will only address a part of the caseload growth.
With that, we'll go on to Ms. Ames.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Linda Ames with Budget Management Division, and we recommend approval of the request.
Ms. McGlashan.
Again, Mr. Chair, and members of the subcommittee, LFO recommends approval of the request.
Yes, Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this question is largely academic, I realize. Do we differentiate at all with respect to the income levels of families receiving these benefits?
Chair Devlin, Senator Morris, no, we do not. The child is determined as disabled under one of the 13 categories of the federal government. We must serve them and provide services for them.
Thank you.
This has got to be me. Any additional questions?
Good idea.
Is there a motion to recommend to the full committee?
So moved.
So moved. Are there any objections?
So stated.
Please note that Representative Crump objects. I will carry it full. Thank you very much.
We will go on to the next agenda.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, our next request is for $2 million in other funds spending limitation in two positions as the means of implementing the requirements of Senate Bill 1071, and Vicki Fleming, Deputy Superintendent for the department, is here to provide additional detail.
Good morning, Chair Devlin, members of the committee. For the record, Vicki Fleming, Deputy Superintendent, Oregon Department of Education. First of all, I just want to say thank you for the leadership that you provided to give us this opportunity to start something in Oregon, which is unique in the country In terms of the virtual school district concept, but not unique in terms of the opportunity that it provides for students. Wanted you to know that we are really not on the front end of this curve, that there are probably many other states. In my research last night as I was reading, there are at least 21 statewide programs as of the summer of 2005, with the largest statewide distance education program being in Utah and serving over 35,000 students. Most of those programs around the country have been established either by the legislature, by the State Department of Education, or through a partnership with local education agencies or ESDs, in fact. So it's not unique that the state legislature would, in fact, direct the State Department of Education and the State of Oregon to provide these opportunities for students. But we do think the Oregon Virtual School District is a unique opportunity, and I'd be happy to answer any of your questions. I know that there are those of you on the committee who have some expertise in this area. We have begun to implement and plan for the implementation of the Virtual School District. I have some information that I can provide. I left some handouts with Ms. McGlashan that will give you some detail about what we think the program will cost. In early 2005, in anticipation of us needing to take some leadership on this set of issues, we issued an RFP, and we had an alliance of folks respond to that RFP for the design of a framework for distance education in Oregon. And the participants in that alliance included representatives of the ESD system, the community college system, the university system, and they actually sat down, and an existing school district program, Salem-Keizer Online. They provided us with a proposed framework about how we might do this in Oregon, and we were in receipt of that, actually the final deliverables in October. I have three extra copies of that. If any of you are needing more paper on your desk or more things to read, you're welcome to have these to take them home with you. But I tell you this so that you know that we did anticipate and hoped for this opportunity to be given to us, and that we have done a fair amount of really deep thinking about how we would implement this program. So currently in Oregon, there are between 350 and 400 course offerings in the K-12 system that are offered in an online environment, and I'm guessing that that count probably does not include the new startup of the Oregon Connections Academy, which Representative Krupp is very knowledgeable about. Those are offered by 7 ESDs, 3 school districts, and 2 university programs. There are over 1,000 community college courses offered in an online environment, and approximately 1,200 university courses offered. The deliverables in this proposal included a framework and a financial model for a portal and a course database, a model for inclusion of existing coursework that programs are providing around the state now, development of Oregon standards for how we would provide education in a virtual environment, dual credit and advanced placement offerings to be included in this framework. And last but not least, we asked them to take a look at what kind of technological redundancies would exist in the system and what we might do in the implementation of this concept to reduce some of those redundancies and make the system work more efficiently. So I will stop there. We are requesting the expenditure limitation. Apparently the detail was left undone at the end of the session. Increase the department's expenditure limitation so we can go forward with the implementation of this and authorize us to have a couple of positions that will actually work on the project.
Questions for the department? Yes,
Representative. Thank you. Vicki, thanks for getting in touch with me, and hope you got my message in response. A couple of questions for you. Why should we spend $2 million to develop a program that's already been developed and is available to Oregon children today for free? And before I go any further, let me state for the record that I have a potential conflict here, as I am the chairman of the board of Oregon's Connections Academy, the school board of that organization, which has enrolled close to 700 students, has hired teachers, is operating today as a charter school under Oregon laws under the Sile School District. So I have some knowledge of both school districts, even though I'm learning very quickly. Our program is, in essence, educating children for about $5,000 a kid. And it is all available today. So why are we spending a couple of million bucks to develop a program that's already out there for free?
Chair Devlin, Representative Krupp, that's a great question. And I think the simple answer is there are programs and online opportunities that are available currently. There is not equal access to those programs for every student in Oregon's public education system. And the concept behind the virtual school district was to be able to connect every Oregon public education student to every opportunity that's funded with a public dollar. So the idea in this concept is that we have a host-provider relationship. We have many good distance learning programs, including yours. They're all over the state. They're not necessarily all in one place, so that I could sit down with my high school student and say, if you want an advanced placement course, here's where you might go to get that. If you want to do credit recovery, here's where you might go to get that. If you want to do a dual credit opportunity with a university or a community college, here's where you might go to do that. And so the idea here is to build a technological infrastructure to connect all of the existing online programs and opportunities. And then there's a directive in the bill that says we need to have some sort of standard and guideline about what the quality of that learning environment is. We don't currently have that. It's an issue statewide. There's really not a good body of research around what works and what doesn't in a virtual environment. So all of those directives in Senate Bill 1071 direct the department to figure that out. The line item budget that's included in that handout really gives you some notion of what at least the people who are doing this work currently think that it would cost to build this host-provider relationship. So you go to a portal. Anything that Oregon State University offers would be clearly identifiable and accessible there. Anything that Salem-Keizer offers would be clearly identifiable and accessible there. There wouldn't be different ways, hopefully at some point, of conveying information or enrolling or registering in any of those programs, because there would be a streamlined process for access. So if a student at Crane High School wants a foreign language and it's provided by Oregon State University, they can go to this portal and they can get access to it and have it be part of their high school transcript at that point.
Chair Foley?
Yes.
You mentioned that you don't think there's equal access. I mean, we have children enrolled from most of the school districts around the state. We have board members from school board members that are from various geographic areas of the state. I have some difficulty in understanding that part of the argument. Oregon's virtual, our Connections Academy, Oregon Connections Academy, is open to anyone. Anyone in the public school. It's a public charter school. And we have children, many of whom have left the public schools. We've gotten a large number of homeschoolers who are now part of our academy. We also have a large number of students who dropped out of school, who see this as an alternative method of learning for them, because maybe they just didn't fit in the public school for some reason. And it's working very well, and we're very pleased with the results we have so far. So when we talk about results, I guess why do we need to develop a standard or guideline on results? I mean, don't these children have to take tests to comply with Oregon's law?
Chair Devlin, Representative Krupp, the answer to that is obviously yes, and I know that you're on the frontier of this work. And the idea, I think, about equal access. They have access to, as I appreciate, your charter environment. What we don't have equal access to are the post-secondary opportunities and the advanced placement opportunities that are currently provided in other programs. And it has some to do, I think, with the connectivity and the computing capacity. I understand that the learning model, and I appreciate that you sent me some additional information on that, that the instruction for the Oregon Connections Academy is actually done in the home and that the parent and the family are very closely involved in that. That's not an opportunity that works for every Oregon public
education students. So this is a way of connecting, personalizing individual opportunities to students and matching the learning environment to the students' needs in a way that we don't have the opportunity to do currently.
Mr. Chair, two more questions and then I'll be quiet. The first one is the Oregon Education Association recently submitted a list of concerns about the Oregon Connections Academy program. And in my mind, it sort of challenges whether Oregon Connections Academy ought to be allowed to operate within the virtual, to operate as a virtual charter school under Oregon's law. So can you tell me what is ODA's thinking regarding OEA's concerns?
Chair Devlin, Representative Krupp, I would not presume to speak for the Oregon Education Association.
Not asking you to.
All right.
I'm asking you what your thinking is in regards to their concerns. What does ODA think about the concerns OEA has put forth?
Chair Devlin, Representative Krupp, it's my job to carry out the statute and the law that you pass and to implement and the directive that you have given us. The politics around that are great in terms of this environment because we truly are frontiering something very new. There are concerns about teacher licensure, certification, what kind of a learning environment, what can we guarantee about what the students in that environment receive at the other end. All of those things I would anticipate that we would like to come back and have a regular update with you. And since you're on the floor of this, we're on the floor of this. In fact, the nation is on the floor, and there's not a lot of good research to tell us what works and what doesn't. We're going to need to develop this together. And I think we need to address all of the concerns that are represented by the teacher corps as the professional community that actually does the work with students, as well as make sure that we're adhering to Oregon law. I wouldn't go any further than that at this point.
Okay, and last question, Mr. Chairman. Senate Bill 1071 had a provision in it, as you know, that states that any virtual charter school has to have 50% of its students from the sponsoring district. Oregon Connections Academy, which was begun and chartered and granted a charter before Senate Bill 1071 was passed, does not meet that requirement. Okay, so is it ODE's position, is your agency's position, that we are in fact grandfathered and are not subject to the requirements of 50% from the sponsoring district specified in Senate Bill 1071?
Chair Devlin, Representative Krupp, I would rather speak to the language in the bill rather than ODE's position because I think that's more pertinent to the question that you're asking. The bill, in fact, does not grandfather in the Oregon Connections Academy in the language stated in the bill. We have the obligation to go if that is challenged, we would have the obligation to go back and do the research with you, both related to the charter school law, and if there is a need to pursue waivers related to that law, then we would do that. I think the assumption at this point is that the SIO school district has a legal contract with the Oregon Connections Academy and approved the charter, and we would honor that agreement as the way we do charter schools in Oregon.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Vicki.
Any additional questions? Ms. Ames? Senator Schrader, did you have a question?
I just follow up on Representative Krupp's last line of questions. I have some concerns, almost a little bit the opposite, a little bit. I'm just trying to think this through in that, charter schools are chartered by local school districts, and that allows them, hopefully, flexibility based on the needs and philosophy of that local school board and school district. And so, I was a little concerned that, students from other districts would have, a kind of unlimited access, and wondered about how that would play into the philosophy, and would that be crossing the line in terms of invading those school districts' ability to set up their own charter or their own virtual school. They maybe have a little different philosophy. How would parents in SIO feel about Pearl District, school district, whatever that might be, setting up something and having a whole bunch of course offerings? Would that be the type of course offerings that they would feel comfortable with? So I'm kind of comfortable with some sort of overall standard, as long as it's not too punitive. And I appreciate the leadership that SIO and you in particular, Representative, have done in this area. But as long as it's not onerous, I think we have to work through this. I could see this bill being modified, quite frankly, in the future. I think the Senator Devlin did a good job trying to bring something forward to get some rationale, give us a handle on this whole thing. And I, for one, probably don't see this. I don't think any of us see this as the final word at this point. We are pioneering, as Ms. Fleming has indicated. And hopefully this will give us an opportunity to answer some of these questions. What's the proper ratio? How does it affect the ADMW in Canby School District, for instance, if we got a bunch of people going on, particularly if they're homeschoolers, which classically don't get ADMW? I mean, we have to figure out what the balance is. I don't know the answer, to be frank with you. So I'm hopeful this is an opportunity for us to move forward and, you know, kind of work this proper balance out. So I appreciate the opportunity to work on this.
I think one of the things that's misunderstood about the bill, and if I might back up here for just a moment and give the caveat that's usually given at these meetings, this is a budget-related committee, not a policy-related committee, is that, well, any school might not be able to claim the ADMW. One of the intents under the bill is if a school is providing some sort of an instruction that's being utilized in another district, that there will be a method of compensation. That's in the bill. That would mean you might have a course that became very popular that literally you have 5,000 students enrolled in around the state, and the entity that was providing that course would receive some compensation. They may not receive ADMW credit, but there would be some compensation for providing that. That's actually within the bill and actually within the language of the bill. So I just wanted to clarify that.
And Mr. Chair, if I may also state for the record that we at Oregon Connections Academy do not believe that we are subject to the provisions in Senate Bill 1071, as we believe we are grandfathered and chartered. However, I should also state that in regards to that particular point, if we have students from other school districts, we give back to that school district 5% of the ADMW that Oregon Connections Academy and the SIO School District receives. We give that back to that school district, even though that school district is not, in essence, providing any services to that child at all. Because we think that is a fair idea, and I think it falls in line clearly with the concept that you've just articulated as part of Senate Bill 1071.
Any additional questions? Ms. Ames.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Linda Ames with Budget Management Division. We recommend approval of the request with one small modification. The positions would actually not be established until the first of the year, so there's a small reduction in the FTE needed.
Ms. McGlashan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of
the committee. And I might comment, this might be Ms. McGlashan's last time before this committee on this side.
Got it. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Legislative Fiscal Office concurs with the BAM recommendation to increase the other funds limitation by $2 million and approve the establishment of two positions, and that would be with a corresponding 1.13 FTE. And then Legislative Fiscal is also recommending that you request DAS to unschedule $1 million of the limitation, and this would be for the second year until a more detailed budget is provided to both Legislative Fiscal and Department of Administrative Services.
Any additional questions? Do we have a motion to the full committee?
Mr. Chair, I move the LFO. I'm okay with the LFO recommendation. Increase the other funds expenditure limitation by $2 million, the two permanent positions, 1.13 FTE, and scheduling $1 million for the second year, and getting the detailed budget to both LFO and BAM.
Are there any objections to the motion?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not going to object. I just want to state for the record, I have concerns about spending this amount of money for the reasons that I've stated. But also I see that I want us to move forward as a state with technology here and the opportunities that technology affords for some students in the public school arena, and based on that, I'm going to vote yes, and I do appreciate the recommendation to unschedule some of that money until we have a more detailed description of how the expenditures will go in the future. So I'm going to be a yes vote.
Others? Okay. With no objection, the motion passes. Senator Schrader, will you
hear? Sure. Go on to the next item, which is the Board of Pharmacy. Would the agency please come forward? Can I ask that you summarize your proposed meeting?
Hey, Deborah, how's it going?
Pretty good.
I will probably wait a moment until I regain a form.
Mr. Jerry, you're a commanding presence. I can see that.
Well, we didn't say anything.
It's Kelly's fault.
And this should be the, one of the least controversial proposals.
We're hoping so.
By Deborah.
I'm just kidding.
Just kidding. Just kidding.
Off to a fine start. I confess. Would you like me to go there?
Oh, yeah.
Take some butt, Mr. Chair.
Sorry about that.
Just wander off anytime. That's fine.
Okay. Will you please proceed?
Good morning, Chair Devlin and members of the committee. My name is Karen McLean, and I'm the Administrative Director of the Oregon Board of Pharmacy, and I'm here today on behalf of Executive Director Gary Schnabel, who was unable to attend due to a previous commitment. With me today is the most immediate past president of the board, pharmacist Blake Rice. The Oregon Board of Pharmacy requests an expenditure limitation of federal grant funds that the board received through the Harold Rogers Grant Program. A portion of the funds are specifically designated for planning relating to the development of a prescription drug reporting program. An executive summary was provided with our request describing these programs. In short, a prescription drug reporting program is a system in which data for controlled substance prescriptions dispensed by pharmacies in the state is submitted to a central database administered by an authorized state agency. As stated in our request, the board received legislative authorization to apply for $350,000 in a grant that we received for planning and implementation of a program. Today, we are asking for $50,000 of those planning funds. These funds will be used to educate stakeholders statewide. The stakeholder group includes authorized prescribers such as physicians, naturopaths, dentists, nurse practitioners, etc., in addition to pharmacies, law enforcement, and other stakeholder associations. Planning funds will also be used to coordinate stakeholders' coalition, evaluate program needs such as database providers and data security, to evaluate ways to enhance the program, such as identify treatment options and provide public education. As indicated in Legislative Fiscal Analyst Deborah Manthey's report, the board has applied for and received a grant extension to the original grant period. The extension was granted to allow the board time to demonstrate in the next year how we will have progressed with the planning for a program. Planning is critical to protect the remaining $300,000 of the grant funds for implementation. If we fail to show significant progress, we will not be able to apply for another grant extension. The board understands that authorizing legislation is necessary to implement a program. We are not asking for an endorsement of a program right now. We are just asking for the planning funds. We would be happy to answer any questions that you may have, and thank you for your consideration.
Any questions for the agency? Yes, Senator Schrader.
Yes, I appreciate the chair's earlier admonition about the budget process. However, it's relevant to this determination. Why did the enabling legislation not pass this past session, I guess, to the best extent of your knowledge?
Senator Devlin, Senator Schrader, our sense of why the enabling legislation did not pass was simply an issue of timing. And I don't know if you want to add something more to that, Blake?
That's specifically why it didn't pass. There are concerns, the state has concerns, and the constituency in Oregon has concerns about federal involvement, period, especially with all the things happening in the Supreme Court right now. And I think there was just bad timing for us, and we didn't anticipate that, and so we didn't have the stakeholders educated to come to our defense in this. And I think that's why it didn't make it through. There was some support within the legislative body itself, It didn't make it out of committee to get past that. I think that the legislation itself was well written, very protective of patient rights, physician rights. Some of the groups we worked with were very pleased with it. I just didn't get out to get a vote.
Yes.
If we approve the LFO and perhaps it was the BAM recommendation also of the $30,000 instead of the $50,000, I assume it's conceivable that we could approve this, enabling legislation does not pass, and then that $30,000 comes out of our general fund. Is that correct?
No.
Okay.
Senator Devlin, Senator Schrader, no. It was clear from the grant's perspective that any planning funds that are spent are funds that are just spent. We don't have to return those.
Okay. I'm sorry, follow-up. Do we already have the money, to federal money, to take care of that, or is that part of the anticipated federal grant?
No, we already have the funds.
Is that okay? That helps. Thank you.
And my understanding is, Senator Schrader, they can only spend the money at this point for planning for that very reason, because if they do something else, we might have to actually pay it back in general fund dollars.
Okay.
Yeah, no, it would be specific for that purpose only.
Any additional questions? Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, College Bureau Supervisor of Management, we are recommending approval of this request at $50,000, which I think is concurrent with what your staff is recommending. I think Deborah's recommendation, though, is that we unschedule a portion of those dollars
for any
additional information. So we are recommending approval of the request, understanding that they'll come back to the 2005 Legislative Assembly with more information and probably more work with the stakeholders.
Yeah. Ms. Mann.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Legislative Fiscal recommends approval of the request with the understanding that Department of Administrative Services would unschedule $30,000 of it. At this point, the agency doesn't have a real detailed spending plan, and that was the idea, that this would allow them to get started, then come in with a detailed spending plan, and then Department of Administrative Services could administratively reschedule it, and they wouldn't have to return to the emergency board. It was just a little too early yet to tell exactly how the planning dollars would be spent.
Senator Morse.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm unclear with respect to the $350,000 grant, the balance of that grant, and how it's going to be used, and is it, or does it actually require implementing Oregon statutes for the balance of that program, and are we getting the cart ahead of the horse here if, in fact, the policy issue hasn't been decided? I'm a little confused with respect to this, the rest of the grant.
Ms. Manthi, can you?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, I think there was some conversation about that when the agency came before you in January 2004 to request approval to apply for the grant. And I think when they applied for the grant, it was known that they needed enabling legislation, and so there would be this timing issue. And the idea was they would come forward in the 2005 session, get the enabling legislation, and then they would be able to spend the whole $350,000. That didn't happen, and so they want to access the planning portion so that they can work with the stakeholders and revise the proposal and hopefully work to be more successful in 2007. At that time, then they could access with the extensions, because they will have to apply for an annual extension from the Bureau of Justice Assistance each time. So the dollars are kind of in holding, but what they worked out with their federal partners is that if they progress towards that, then we can still retain the $300,000, and it will be available should the legislature approve the program in 2007. And if that doesn't happen, the funds will go back.
And is everything like this, they need the expenditure limitation to spend any of the dollars, so all we're authorizing them is to spend up to 50 with 30,000 unscheduled until they can justify it.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. Thought of something and then I lost it, so I apologize.
You're younger than I am, geez.
Mr. Chair, I think Ms. McLean wanted to say something.
Yes, Ms. McLean.
Chair Devlin, Senator Morris, it might also help you to know that two sessions ago, This legislation was introduced at that time, and we were told to go find funding. And so we were able to apply for the grant funds, and we did receive them. And now it is a matter of being able to access those planning funds. So that was part of the policy discussion two sessions ago, was go get money. So we were able to obtain those funds through the grant process. That assists you at all.
Thank you.
Yes.
Part of the need also to access these dollars right now is to demonstrate to the grantor that the agency is making progress. If they don't spend some of these dollars, they won't be able to demonstrate that. Well, it'd be harder to demonstrate that, and therefore they would lose out. So that's the other reason for coming in for the planning funds right now, maybe having the cart a little bit before the horse. But the horse won't be there if they can't get this part going.
Any additional questions? Let's see, we did finish your presentation.
Physically, we did.
Okay. See, I'm older. Okay. Is there a motion on floor?
I'd like to make a particular motion similar to the one that Alpo has recommended, that we establish a $50,000 expenditure limitation for planning portion of $350,000 grant from the U.S. Department of Justice to develop this prescription drug monitoring program, and on schedule $30,000 of that $50,000 until the agency demonstrates a need for the limitation and the agency come forward. The documentation, quantifiable documentation of the current problem and what this grant will enable us to improve or fix.
Yes.
Can I get clarification? Are they bringing that report forward to the Department of Administrative Services for our consideration for unscheduling it, or did you want them to return to the emergency board with that information?
I'd like them to come back to the emergency board with the information. You can do it at the time the monies are unscheduled. That would be fine.
With $20,000 for the January emergency,
we're
trying to figure out how
we don't have to ask for another extension until next July, so we have until next July, and that would be sufficient.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Any additional questions? There is a motion on the floor. Are there any objections to the motion? Hearing none, the motion passes. Senator Schrader, since you amended it, would you carry it?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
We will move on now to the military department. We will take just a moment to see. You're not absent without leave. Colonel Caldwell, it's good to see you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it's a pleasure to be here today. For the record, my name is Colonel Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department. Today we have two items before you. I'll start off with the first item, we request approval of an allocation of $248,617 from the emergency fund and three limited duration positions to administer the Oregon National Guard reintegration program and enhance our public affairs operations. The Oregon National Guard reintegration program was established during the 2003-2005 biennium, mainly in response to a critical need arising from our Oregon soldiers and airmen returning from war zone deployments. We recognized that our returning soldiers and airmen require assistance to reintegrate back into civilian life. The demanding deployments in Iraq and Afghanistan have placed considerable strain on the soldiers, airmen, and their families. Since 2001, the Oregon National Guard has mobilized over 70% of our total force, and in the process and frustration experienced by our returning veterans, in applying for assistance jobs for some, about 30 to 40% of those deployed in making their transition back to normalcy, has created a need to provide a central service clearinghouse, if you will, to support these soldiers and airmen. This program assists Oregon National Guard members experiencing hardships related to the activation, lack of pay, benefits, delay in securing discharge, and post-traumatic stress disorder, which we've seen a good deal of. It provides a central point of contact for Oregon National Guard soldiers and airmen, where they can call one number, get a hold of fellow veterans, fellow soldiers, and get directed to the services and the providers who provide these services for their health and welfare. I could go on and on about the successes that we've had. I'll cut it short, but I will tell you this, that the many of these soldiers who have called our 1-800 number, this team does more than just sit at the phone and listen. They go out and they brief families. They go before the soldiers return. They make contacts with veteran service organizations, ODBA, and also the Federal Department of Veterans Affairs, to make sure that they're linked up and our soldiers are getting the care and the service and the need they so richly deserve. They also work with employers, they work with communities, law enforcement agencies at every level, city, county, and state, to try to make sure that when we end up, as we will have in the next 2 weeks, about 650 soldiers coming back to Eastern Oregon communities, that these young men and women are going to be back in the community and there could be some issues. What we've been able to anecdotally discover out of this is that in many cases where a law enforcement officer would typically take one course of action based on the behavior that they've observed, once they recognize, or at least they're tuned in and they're sensitized, and they're asking questions if these people have been deployed recently, and when they find out they are, they treat them a little differently, get them the kind of help that they deserve instead of just handcuffs in a jail cell. So we've seen that in more than one occasion, both with the 2nd of the 162nd Infantry and also with some other units that we've had return. We believe that this program should be a federally supported 100% program. Unfortunately, it is not. Right now, the federal government has allowed us to shift some of our limited resources that they provide, and we have actually one person. We did have two. Now we've got one federal resource in this group, and then the other three people of the group, one's federal and two are state. We think the program's going to be, we know that we're going to be in this business for at least another 2 years, but we're hoping that the federal government will step up and fence specific money and make this a mandatory program and provide the funds to fund this, and we can get it off the state nickel. We did run it in the last biennium. We double-filled positions. We recognized the need to make this coordination, and it worked quite well. And it's been a very successful program, and we're very pleased with it. Second part of the request is for Public Affairs Office. We've 1995, our Public Affairs Office had 4.5 state FTE and one federal position for a total of 5.5 FTE. Today we have one state position and two federal positions. One of the federal positions is currently vacant. The workload has increased fourfold during this time frame, and the number of people available to perform the work has declined. We request your approval for an additional half-time public information representative, one position, as this is necessary to ensure that we are properly communicating with our soldiers, airmen, and the general public. Primary function of this position include maintaining information resources, resource material files, consulting with the Oregon National Guard leadership regarding sensitive or controversial issues, and to assure constant, consistent response to the public in internally and externally. The position tracks, reviews, and reports leadership in legislative activity as well. They assist me in the legislative activity. The half-time public information position has been funded so far with other fund carryover. That's how we initiated it in the last biennium, and we've been funding it with that. And I would request that position be approved and funded if we could. That concludes my testimony on these two items.
Any questions for Colonel Caldwell? Yes, Representative Crump.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question for the chair, actually.
Yes.
I noticed that in the Human Services Subcommittee that the agency has given the National Guard has given a report this morning on their activities and deployment of troops for Hurricanes Katrina and Rita. Yeah. If at the end of the formal business with the Guard this morning, if the chair could indulge, could we have a couple of minutes maybe that Colonel Caldwell could share with us that information just briefly?
A couple of minutes, yes. We have two items at the end of the agenda that I hope do not get lengthy, but they could get lengthy.
Okay, well,
Colonel Caldwell, the reintegration program, you know, many of the reasons that you brought forward are reasons that are known to me as having spent some time with your folks talking about these issues both in Iraq and certainly home here. One of the people that you've sort of found a way to help is Luke Wilson, who was one of your 2162 guys who lost a leg over there to an RPG. He's an outstanding young man. I'm very, very, very pleased to have known him and know that he goes out and he spends time talking to other soldiers who've lost limbs. Luke has lost a leg over there. And I think he's been very effective at that. So when you're talking about reintegration, are some of those positions going to be, are you going to look to people like Luke Wilson, guys who've been there to come back and help these soldiers reintegrate?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Krupp, what we've discovered, and I suspect we didn't have to look very hard within our own group to know this, was that most of these soldiers, when they come back, if they have issues, they're not real willing to share those issues with those that have not served. One. Secondly, they're less likely to share them with somebody who has not been in that same situation, in a combat situation. So when we looked at who we needed to get in here to, you know, to be that portal, to be that go-to person, somebody with the combat experience was very important. In Luke's case, you know, where he did lose his leg, and he did have spent a year in rehabilitation, a year and a half. Many of these young men and women who have difficulties that have come back identify with him very readily, and that is a great, great asset because they know that coming in, they're willing to pick up the phone and talk to somebody like that where they wouldn't be willing to talk to somebody like yourself or me perhaps. Because we haven't been there, we haven't shared that same experience. So he's been incredibly effective because of that situation that he was in, and we're seeing him be able to. He receives calls in the middle of the night from soldiers who are really having some difficulty, and I'm afraid in some cases that they weren't calling him, or Sergeant Jocks was another one who was in there who was also wounded and recovered. I'm afraid we would have had suicides or other issues because these people were really, really having trouble. And they picked up a phone and called them. So I think there is a distinct advantage to having that type of individual on this team. And that's what when we figured that out and kind of listened to the research that came from ODVA and from the federal VA and talking to our own soldiers and getting the feedback from our own soldiers that had experienced difficulties, they were very readily opening up to those folks where they wouldn't talk to the rank and file military bureaucrat, if you will, or Veterans Affairs bureaucrat. Just wouldn't do it. They go through sittings and meetings, sound fine. 24 hours later, they're on the phone to him saying, I got problems. And they wouldn't say it to somebody else. So I think it's really paid us big dividends. We're real pleased to have him.
Any additional questions for the agency?
Mr. Chairman, I would move we approve the request.
Oh, we still have to hear from BAM and
Bombay. My apologies. I'm trying to move things along here.
Yes, please proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee. This is Satish Upadhyay with the Department of Administrative Services. We recommend that you allocate $248,617 from the State Emergency Fund and establish 3 permanent positions. This would be equivalent to 2.08 full-time equivalent positions for the current biennium.
Thank you. Ms. Jordan.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Legislative Fiscal Office recommends the allocation of the $248,617 from the emergency fund, but that the positions be limited duration, not permanent, with the understanding that military will continue to aggressively seek federal funding for the positions, and if federal funds are secured for the reintegration program, that the Department of Administrative Services will unschedule the remaining general fund. I just point out that the agency had discussed this issue with the legislature during their budget hearings and that they were trying to secure the federal funds, and the legislature directed them to return to the emergency board if federal funds were not secured. The agency is continuing to work with the federal government. Their budget cycle is off from the state's budget cycle, and we are
they have high hopes that the Department of Defense will follow through and provide those funds. So we recommend that they be limited duration until we sort out that funding.
Do we have a motion to the full committee?
You do, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. It's been moved to approve the LFO recommendation. Are there any objections? Hearing none. Motion passes. Representative Scott, will you carry?
Sure.
We will go on to number 17. Still with you, Colonel.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record again, I'm Colonel Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director of the Military Department. Second request today is requesting federal fund expenditure limitation increase of $98,186, along with the establishment of one fiscal analyst position to support our civil engineering program at Kingsley Field in Klamath Falls. We were notified in August 2005 of the availability of additional federal funding to support a fiscal analyst position with the civil engineering program on the Kingsley Field Air National Guard Base in Klamath Falls. Civil engineering program provides facility operations and maintenance for Kingsley Field. The position requested is required to provide equipment accounting and budgeting services for Kingsley Field facilities operations and maintenance functions and to serve as a liaison to the Fiscal Administration Division here at the Military Department. This position, again, is a vital, intricate part of our total operational budget. There, as you know, or as you may not know, 15% of the total operations of the air base at Kingsley Field is paid for by the state of Oregon. It's our job to monitor those funds and make sure that the total number of federal and state funds are spent there that are done properly. So this is a very good thing. We've been asking the Air National Guard for about 3 years now for this position, and we finally got them to give it to us from Washington, D.C., so we're very delighted to have it because we think it's important so we don't overstress what's already going on and we get our accounting correctly. So I'll curtail my comments to that comment and request your approval.
Any questions to the agency? Hearing none, did BAM give their...
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee, the Department, this is Satish Upadhyay with the Department of Administrative Services. We recommend that you approve this request.
Ms. Jordan?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we concur.
Okay. Do we have a...
So moved, Mr. Chairman.
Are there any...
Excuse me, I didn't get in queue here quick enough. I noticed this is 100% federally funded, but it's an exception from past practice, which has required state matching funds. I guess my question is, what's the probability, if we have any guess as to what might that be, that defense would renege down the road and say, you have to take care of this in matching funds.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Morris, typically when they add these positions, as I said, we've been requesting additional assistance in this arena. Typically when they add them, they do not come back and ask for the match. Doesn't mean it couldn't happen. If it did happen, it would be 15%.
Okay.
It's not a 50-50 or a dollar for dollar. It's 15%. At the Portland Air Base, we support the Portland Air Base civil engineering costs. It's for the base operations, basically. We support that at 20% for state money, 80% federal money. Majority of the base is run by 100% federal money. But the maintenance, like heat, groundskeeping, that sort of thing, is 20 and 15. That's probably the worst that could ever happen. And I don't anticipate that would happen because it doesn't fit within that category. It fits in accounting as opposed to base operations.
Thank you. Do we have a motion?
We do have a motion.
So moved. Any objections? Hearing no objections, the motion passes. I will carry. Thank you very much, Colonel Caldwell.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir. Oh, the 2 minutes.
Yeah. thank you for the indulgence. Colonel, briefly, in talking to some members of the 2162, which deployed in Katrina and Rita the other day at their change of command ceremony, I listened to some of the troops describe their activities down there and some of their communications issues, some of the issues revolving around communication at the local level, state officials, the Pentagon, the fact that our troops were deployed down there under the authority of the governor of Louisiana and not the Pentagon. We're sending troops, and these guys just come home from Iraq. We're sending them back out. We've got 900 guys going over to Afghanistan here. We're getting stretched pretty thin here. And what I'm concerned about is, what do we have left here in Oregon that we've not overstressed these people? And how do we deal with that based on the experiences that your guys had down in Katrina? What do we need to do here?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Crump, I think the guard total is 8,000 soldiers and airmen. We prepared this for the other committee. They didn't want it. I'll be more than happy to share it with you, but it's a it's just basically a walkthrough of what occurred in this operation. And I think if I was in your shoes, I guess if you look at the first page and you see what happened in this operation, we basically went from a dead stop on a holiday weekend and from a request to having a little less than 2,000 people on the ground supporting Operation Katrina and the state of Louisiana within 4 days.
Which is again, phenomenal.
It is rather phenomenal. In fact, we know that we could have been there in 2.5, maybe 3 at the most, or maybe 2 if we'd had the airflow to get us there. We simply didn't have the aircraft to get us there. So I think from a practical standpoint, looking at the state of Oregon, and that is roughly a quarter of the total National Guard, take out another, let's say, 10% that are deployed. So you got 50 to 60% of the National Guard, your National Guard, sitting in the state of Oregon today. Even during Katrina, you had them. And we were able to operate and move 2,000, 2,500, 3,000 miles out of 4 days and do very effective operations in that state. I think the same applies here, but it would be rather quicker. I think the biggest issue that we face right now, and one of the issues that we're pushing the United States Congress presently before they wrap up their defense bill, is the lack of equipment. Our equipment right now is in such state that most of it, as we deploy, we leave it in theater, we come home without it. And right now we're short somewhere around 300 trucks, just to give you an example. And that's pretty significant. And so our biggest issue right now is not personnel. It isn't getting to the fight wherever it may be. It's getting there with the equipment that we desperately need. So that's our biggest issue currently. I think from a practical standpoint, talking about the communication issues, initially that did create some issues. If you look further into this diagram, you'll see some diagrams of how the force structure was put together, how the task forces were put together. And within about 3 or 4 days of us being there, all of a sudden General Pritt became in charge of everything. And not just what we had on the ground, but he became in charge of everything. And I think that speaks well to our ability to do our job and our ability to communicate not only up and down the chain. And it did create some issues with respect to change of command, and particularly when the active component showed up with the three-star general. Suddenly they wanted to take over, but they didn't have the legal authority to take over. So I think, again, his skill and ability played well in that particular instance, as he was able to work those issues through and did not affect what was happening on the ground and the service that we were trying to provide to the citizens of Louisiana. So I think any way you look at this particular operation, it was a real major success for us, and I think it demonstrated that the National Guard can come within a matter of very short order, get to the particular incident, and deliver what people expect to be there. Unfortunately, Louisiana couldn't do it because they were fighting for their lives initially, and their communication was totally destroyed, and they could not deal with their own problems, let alone help anybody else. And that was really what happened as we were starting to analyze the situation.
Mr. Chairman, Colonel, you bring up a really good point there, because that we've heard so much in the news about the disconnect in communications issues. So what I want to know, next week I'm going to D.C. and New York, and I'm going to New York to visit their terrorism center there, and they're going to be talking about their dirty bomb scenarios that they're planning for there. What happens in Oregon if we have a major disaster, maybe a huge earthquake, maybe we have a dirty bomb go off in Portland? How are we set to communicate at the local level, at our local county levels, with you guys, so that we don't end up with the problems that happened down in Louisiana, where you have this massive confusion? But how are we set to do that? I know we got OEM in the room, so that's a question I'm probably going to ask them too, because I'm concerned about the ability for us to communicate between each other so that we don't end up with this disconnect.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Crump, it's not a perfect system at this point. I think OEM would agree with that.
We still have communications issues. I know that there's been a lot of effort going forth through Office of Emergency Management and the Homeland Security Office to try to resolve a lot of these issues in the interoperability community, because it's a huge issue. And there is that bugaboo out there, and it's not solved yet. And I think if Ken was sitting right here, which I know he's right back here somewhere, he'd probably shake his head yes, that we still need to do a lot of work in that arena. Having said that, I think the most positive thing that we've done here in Oregon, in my estimation, is one, Oregon National Guard's in 37, 38 communities throughout the state. We have divided up the state in our side of the thing, because we work with emergency management. We take their direction. Counties go to them, and then it comes down to us, and then we engage with it at the local level. At the local level, we don't have somebody in every single county. We don't have 36 county or armory in 36 counties, but we have divided up those areas to make sure that we have coverage in those areas. One of the assets that we have traditionally used over the years, and we're trying to make better, I know it's a concern of yours during the session, is the National Guard Reserve or the State Defense Force. Oregon State Defense Force, because they're consistent, they don't move. Our people move. Our normal National Guard, federally supported soldiers move, shoot, they practice to move, shoot, and communicate for the federal government. The State Defense Force, on the other hand, stays in one spot, and they liaison between those counties and that National Guard element. That's an important asset. We're still working those issues. We're still working with OEM to try to sort out the communication and that whole genre. It's not complete, and we've got work to do, and I think, like I said,
Mr. Chair, one last point here. I've got constituents, retired military officers, a couple of them who've contacted me. I've got a gentleman who works for the State Corrections, who's a retired military, who's part of the State Defense Force, and these people want to contribute. The State Defense Force has kind of been ineffective. And part of the vision that I've discussed with Colonel Caldwell, and this is the reason I want to talk about this today, is that we need this liaison at the local county emergency management personnel with their local guard units. Okay? And the State Defense Force can fill that need. And we have high-quality retired military officers and other personnel that want to be a part of this thing. And it's going to take some coordination. And I'd like us, if it's the chair is pleasing, I'd like us to ask Colonel Caldwell to give us some kind of a plan at the next E-Board meeting about how we can make the State Defense Force more effective so we don't, if we have a problem, we don't end up like Louisiana.
What I would say, Representative Krupp, is I would ask you, if you want to do that, to discuss it with the Speaker and the President of the Senate, because they're literally the people who decide what's on the next agenda or a forthcoming agenda. So I would bring it to their attention, and I'm sure Colonel Caldwell would cooperate with you in terms of seeing that discussion occurred.
I would just add, and we would be more than delighted to do that, two issues. One, the Speaker and the President of the Senate are forming a committee, a work group or something. I don't know what the exact official terminology is. There's a press release, I think, last week that talked about it, to do exactly what you're talking about, to look at this whole environment and to see how everybody works and fits. So I think they're on that path. We have tried to re-engineer the State Defense Force to make it more effective. That re-engineering is not complete. General Reese has taken that on as a high agenda item or a high priority item of his, to make this thing as good as it can be with relationship to what it does with OEM and with the Office of Homeland Security, so we can strengthen that piece of our total operation. So I think your timing is apropos because of what the Speaker and the President see as an emerging need, and I guess those of us that have been in this business a long time have always thought about those things. We've worked at them, and now it's really gotten a lot of visibility. So I think the time is right for us to continue to work in that process and to get back to you and this body and the entire legislature and our constituents to let them know what we're doing here in Oregon. So I think things are moving in that direction, and perhaps that's the right vehicle.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Colonel Caldwell.
Yes, sir.
Give my best to General Reese.
Yes, sir.
We will move on to our next agenda item, Oregon Youth Authority.
Mm-hmm.
holding the chair. The chair won't first speak.
She'll be gone for a while.
Before the agency starts, I might note for the record that the Subcommittee on Public Safety for the Joint Ways and Means Committees and both of the subcommittees for the House Budget Committee and the Senate Budget Committee and both Judiciary Committees have spent a great deal of time on the policy issues surrounding the issues they're going to present to you. So please proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Jester, Director of the Oregon Youth Authority. And we are here before you today at the request of a budget note on House Bill 5125, requesting us to come to the emergency board to address potential funding issues that resulted from an outside review committee that looked at a situation involving a former juvenile parole and probation officer with the Youth Authority who was charged with multiple counts of sex abuse involving youth on his caseload. This individual, Mike Boyles, has been convicted and now sentenced for those offenses. There were concerns raised during this process that the agency missed warning signs and that we did not, as an agency, appropriately respond to complaints going back as far as 10 years in this case. In April of this year, I convened an outside external review committee to look into these matters and look at the public safety implications of this case. We put together a group of people representing public safety, child welfare professionals, and asked that they make recommendations on what the agency could do systemically to reduce the possibility this could occur in the future. We had extensive, as the chair mentioned, time before committees talking about these issues and are here today to report back of the 21 recommendations contained in their final report, which was completed Monday. We get down into really four categories of recommendations that will require additional resources for the Youth Authority to move forward. One is the improvement of hiring practices. The second is extensive policy review. The third is enhanced training. And the fourth is a capacity to review and investigate complaints by centralizing, professionalizing, and analyzing that function. Rod Brown, who chaired that review committee, which I would like to say for members and go on the record, this is a group of individuals who spent 6 months going through 25,000 pages of documents, both personnel records, client records, testimony, as well as policies, procedures, etc. They really, really made an outstanding contribution to the improvement of this agency and I think state government as a whole. And I would like to offer, if the chair would agree, for Mr. Brown to make a few comments about the recommendations that the committee's made.
We talked about that yesterday, and I think that would be fine. Mr. Brown, do you want to come forward? Would you please, when you come forward, identify yourself and also identify your background, because I don't think everybody will know.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Rod Brown, and I'm President and Chief Executive Officer of Public Safety Liability Management, a risk management firm specializing in issues of public safety agency risk exposures. Prior to my current occupation, I had a 30-year career as a law enforcement officer, retiring as a chief of police. I was asked to serve as the chair of the Youth Safety and Abuse Prevention Review Committee. The committee was formed at the request of Robert Jester, director of the Oregon Youth Authority, near the beginning of May. The committee was given three specific charges and asked to respond to 9 separate questions. The committee's review thus far, and we have finished, has focused on 9 different areas that include policies, training, personnel practices, early warning systems, supervision of personnel, accountability of employees, investigative practices of complaints made against employees, potential oversight of complaint handling and disposition, and proactive responses to critical incidents. The first and foremost concern of this committee is the protection of youth. With that priority in mind, the committee has worked to fully identify all of the issues and circumstances that may have allowed the abuses by Michael Boyles to occur. Committee members worked very hard to read, digest, and analyze a tremendous amount of information. In the final report, our recommendations come down to a few areas that Director Jester has already identified. They include improved hiring practices, enhanced training, policy and procedural practices, and the handling of complaints against the agency or employees, and systemic accountability. The committee operated autonomously from the oversight of any person, agency, or organization. The individuals comprising this committee were an excellent cross-section of criminal justice and child welfare professionals. Each has a very strong commitment to ethics, integrity, and candor. One of my early statements to the committee was that we would review the material and let the chips fall where they may. This process took longer than we originally anticipated because of several factors, including the concurrent and ongoing criminal prosecution of Michael Boyles and the pending litigation. The voluminous amount of materials to be reviewed, analyzed, and applied to our work, and the thoroughness with which the committee operated, both individually as well as a whole. The cross-section of committee members was invaluable in our discussions in the identification of issues, seeing them from differing perspectives. I firmly believe that any single discipline or professional expertise alone would not have been able to grasp the multiplicity of factors, the collective solutions and alternatives, the melding of opinions, or reach the conclusions and recommendations in a holistic approach. I have reviewed the proposals of both the Legislative Fiscal Office and Department of Administrative Services regarding the funding of these proposals. In reference to the internal investigative function and the external oversight, the committee cannot overemphasize the importance of these functions, and we would appreciate your consideration for immediate implementation. The committee appreciates the opportunity to have served in this capacity and to have contributed to improving the services and safeguarding of our youth. And I'd be glad to answer any questions you may have.
Are there any questions for the agency? Or for Mr. Brown? Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Brown. And I know your service and the service of the committee is appreciated. Bam.
Ready.
I have a question for you, Mr.
Yes.
Chair, sir.
Yes.
Who is the person that Mr. Boyles reported to in a way? Who is his?
Mr. Chair, Senator Schrader, there were a number of persons that were his supervisors during his tenure in his career with state government.
And are they all still currently employed in a way?
Mr. Chair, Senator Schrader, no, they are not.
Are any of them still employed?
Mr. Chair, Senator Schrader, yes, they are.
And why is that, given their lack of carrying out their responsibility in terminating Mr. Boyle's employment?
Mr. Chair, Senator Schrader, a couple things. As we went through this investigation, we looked at individual actions by individual workers prior to and including the process that resulted in Mr. Boyle's dismissal from state service. At the time he was arrested and the prosecution of the case moved forward, we did not do a concurrent investigation not to interfere with the process that was underway. In June of this year, I requested from the Attorney General's office that an independent special counsel be appointed to review the personnel decisions and actions made by the Youth Authority staff as it related to this case. The review committee that Mr. Brown chaired was not given that charge. The update from the Attorney General's office is that they have identified a law firm that specializes in employment law, and they are in the process of doing a contract, and that review will then take place. And
I'm not laughing at your explanation. I apologize, Mr. Chair. Yeah. I'm just very concerned. This is a real straightforward issue to little old me. I mean, there's a chain of command. You know, people are in charge of other people. We can spend a tremendous amount of money, and I appreciate Mr. Brown and his committee's work, and this will hopefully help the agency and, frankly, any agency in how they deal with things. This is just peculiar to OIA, and I'm not singling OIA out. But to me, this is very obvious that, you know, the people that are in charge, unless the newspaper accounts are totally exaggerated, I have not gone through this report, but it's very clear there was a history and a pattern of abuse by Mr. Boyles, not only of the children, but also of the agency. And to me, it's very straightforward. I would assume these would be management positions, not subject to collective bargaining. So you release the people, and in a sense, the clear message to the agency that, yes, I am empowered to deal proactively with employees that are not following the current guidelines of OA. You had some great policies already in place. I mean, I don't fault the agency entirely here. This is real straightforward. The way you impress Kurt Schrader, well, obviously you don't care about me, but that's fine, is that you just go ahead and release those people that were supervising Mr. Boyles during the tenure of this abuse. And the fact that that has not been done is of grave concern to me and tells me the culture of OIA, regardless of all these fancy new hiring practices, training, policy review, nothing's going to change. And I'm very, 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 very concerned about that. Maybe I'm the only member of the committee that has that concern, but I want to see those guys gone. Otherwise, it would be difficult for me in the next session and ensuing sessions to realize there's a lot of accountability in OIA.
I think one of the things that you see when you get into this case, it's an extremely complex case, and that's no excuse. But the reality is that these things went on for years. There were multiple complaints. Things fell through the cracks. This is not an excuse either, but remembering, too, that Mr. Boyle's activities that predated OIA under the Department of Human Services, because that's where he would have been tied to, I believe, an employment prior to this. But I think the committee has done a lot of work on this. I can't, I think Senator Gordley and Senator Winters basically wanted to bring this up every couple of weeks in committee. But Mr. Jester, did you have a response? And
Mr. Chair, Senator Schrader, I appreciate your comment that it's not personal toward the Youth Authority, and I don't take it as such. I think that we are an agency that has a 10-year history that we pride ourselves in accountability. We pride ourselves on staff accountability and youth accountability and protecting the public. We spent a great deal of time when that was possible during our budget presentation talking about our measurable outcomes and the work that we do with young people turning their lives around and reducing recidivism and juvenile crime rate in this state. I believe that the Michael Boyles case is somewhat of an anomaly. I believe that this is an individual who has been described as a sociopath that was able to work through a variety of systems, not just the Oregon Youth Authority or state government. This is an individual who appeared in court on numerous occasions with defense counsel representing youth, with others in the courtroom, including judges. These cases were reviewed independent from the Oregon Youth Authority. There were numerous opportunities as well as numerous independent actions that the Youth Authority took with Mr. Boyles to keep him within the bumpers of our policies. It is absolutely, I believe, the case that when you put all the dots on the board now and you go back and connect the lines, it is very easy to say and see that this is a person that should have been fired on the second or third or fourth occasion that this may have happened. In fact, Mr. Boyles was considered by most people who came in contact with him outside the Oregon Youth Authority to be one of the best examples of a pro-probation worker and a child welfare caseworker, that he was somebody who was responsive, he was somebody who was able to deliver services for his youth, he was somebody who was able to connect youth with the appropriate level of care. The fact that In retrospect, it has now been determined that he was also sexually abusing a group of youth on his caseload. Absolutely does not put that in balance. But I would be remiss to want it to be characterized that our supervisors who work with Mr. Boyles turned a blind eye to his work.
Just the last comment, Mr. Chair. I mean, this agency has been a good agency over the years. We've woefully underfunded it and perhaps has compromised some of their abilities. But there has to be accountability in state government. And this is not unique to OIA, but we always do this transfer shuffle and try and make things work. And there has to be a point at which... again, it's not so much different policies and different monies and new policy. You just have to say, hey, you know, Mr. Boyle, it's not regarding the sexual abuse, just the way he apparently interacted with the agency and his fellow workers was totally inappropriate, and he should have been terminated despite one's expertise a long time ago. And I just hope that you take from me anyway, unless I'm a party of one, the opportunity to take a much harder line towards individuals within the organization that are not team players, that are not working within the guidelines established by OIA, and they would be terminated no matter how great they may appear to be in terms of getting resources or doing this or doing that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Schrader, I absolutely agree with your statement. I think that this has been a wake-up call for this agency. I think it's been a wake-up call for other agencies. And we have taken a very hard look, a very painful look at the culture of the Oregon Youth Authority. And we have made the commitment to not only the review committee, but to the media to be transparent in sharing of documents to say, what is it you want to look at? Take a look at that. Make recommendations to us before you. You have almost 90 pages of documentation. And we also have an implementation plan that the agency is working on to implement the recommended changes that the committee found. So I believe that the agency is attempting to be responsive. However, I appreciate your comment recognition that the Oregon Youth Authority has never been fully funded, and that was stated in the governor's recommended budget. That was stated by the chair of the public safety subcommittee during our budget hearings. And this is a modest request to add necessary resources to directly impact some of the issues that this report has brought to light.
Senator Schrader, have you concluded?
Yes, sir.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The characterization of this example as being an anomaly, my concern is that, we have, I think our conversation here indicated 80 pro and probation officers or approximate number, which would represent probably a very small percentage of employees, state employees, that have direct contact with youth. Would the measures that are going into place here, would they in fact intercept a sociopath, highly skilled and manipulating, and would in fact make a difference? Good hiring practices, training, education, and all those things are essential for any organization, no matter where or what you do. But I'm a little concerned that if this case was an anomaly, and we're spending a lot of money for 80 employees, when actually there are probably hundreds and hundreds of other employees that have the same kind of access to youth.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, I think that's a very good question. And we believe from reviewing the report and meeting with the members of the safety committee, as well as my debrief with Multnomah County District Attorney's Office, as well as the Oregon State Police investigator that was mostly responsible for the investigation conducted with Mr. Boyles, as well as conversations I have had with other state agency heads in my position across the country. We are an agency that does not have the capacity currently to do as thorough background checks. Would these background checks have precluded Mr. Boyles from original hire? The answer to that, I believe, is probably not. Would psychological testing of Mr. Boyles had indicated that there may be an area of concern and having an individual with his psychological profiling working with youth? I can't answer that because I've not seen a psychological profile of him. But I am convinced that it is responsibility of this agency to do everything that it can do to ensure that those individuals we are hiring are suited for this kind of work and do not pose an unnecessary risk to harm the safety of youth that are in our custody. And I believe that the requests that is before you are, again, modest steps to increase the resources to be able to do that. Whether we have 1,100 people that work for the Oregon Youth Authority, we have about a 10% turnover rate per year, and we are absolutely committed to making certain that the 10% of people that we hire each year are appropriately suited for this work, going above and beyond what we have done in the past, which is reference checks, criminal history checks, drug screens, and interviews. But we believe we must go further than that to ensure that our youth are safe. And I would also like to state for the record that I believe that this case is an example of what we read in the papers daily of individuals who have taken advantage of young people in their positions, be it in schools, be it in athletic, be it in churches. And we believe that we have a responsibility, again, to do everything we can to appropriately screen people who are coming into our employment.
Any additional questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the record, Linda Gilbert, Department of Administrative Services, Budget and Management. The original request from the agency was for four permanent full-time positions and one limited duration position and about $725,000 from the emergency fund. The recommendation from Budget and Management is to allocate $461,495 from the State Emergency Fund to increase federal funds expenditure limitation by $24,540, establish one permanent full-time position and one limited duration full-time position to implement the recommendations of the Youth Safety and Abuse Prevention Review Committee. And to be specific, the one permanent position we're recommending is an investigator, and the limited duration position we're recommending is the person who will be responsible for the overall policy review. The funding level contemplates a start date of January 1, 2006.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee. The Legislative Fiscal Office has a different recommendation from either the agency's request or the Budget and Management Division recommendation. In looking at this, it seemed that there were some things that could be done immediately at a low cost, things that would be particularly specific management actions that could be taken, and that would cover the improved hiring practices, the additional training, and the policy review work that was being requested. So those are the three pieces that we are recommending that you approve at this point. And the amount of that is $334,066 general fund, $20,124 federal funds, and one limited duration beginning January 1, 2006 for the policy review piece. So that's what we're recommending at this time. During session, when this issue was discussed, the budget note that was added to the department's budget report indicated that the agency should present the final report to the Joint Interim Judiciary Committee when it first met during the session. That committee isn't in place yet. It hasn't met. And so we're recommending that you defer action on the request for funding for the internal and external complaint offices until those pieces, which I believe have a much bigger policy component to them and statewide potential impact can be discussed by the Judiciary Committee if they choose to do so, but certainly that the Judiciary Committee at least can get the request and take a look at it. And if the Judiciary Committee chooses not to take a look at it, then I would expect that the agency would come back to the Emergency Board for another request at this. But the concerns that we have, in addition to those process concerns, because we originally anticipated Judiciary Committee would want to weigh in on this, On the Internal Complaint Investigation Office proposal, I have some concerns that although the scope of this review and the immediate issue at hand is the Boyles case, that if you establish an Internal Complaint Investigation Office, that is a much broader animal than just alleged abuse of youth in OIA's custody. You can be getting complaints of I don't like the food they serve me here in the facility, or you know, my supervisor isn't being responsive to me, which are not necessarily bad things for an agency to look at or to respond to or to have a defined process for those kinds of complaints. But whether that requires a whole separate office within the agency, and the fact that it is broader than the immediate issues of abuse, I think warrants some additional discussion. So we're not recommending that at this time. And we're not recommending the External Complaint Office at this time because, again, I think there are broader issues to be considered here. At one point, the governor's office did have a public safety ombudsman. Very few states apparently have ombudsman or inspector generals directly specific to juvenile justice activities. That's not to say that it's not a good idea, again, but I think there needs to be further discussion about how this function is set up, where it's set up. Is the governor's office the appropriate place for it, or should it be an independent function? What is the scope of what that office will be dealing with versus what the Internal Investigations Office might be dealing with? How is there some way that this is coordinated, or does it need to be coordinated with the Children's Ombudsman that's currently housed in the Department of Human Services? There's a number of issues there that I think haven't been fully discussed, or at least I haven't been provided information relative to that. And so, again, our recommendation is to just do the three pieces revolving around hiring, training, and policy review, and defer funding for those internal and external complaint offices.
Comment. A couple of things here. One is that I think it's important that we do follow original legislative intent, which was to have the Judiciary Committee review this. I know the chairs may or may not be interested in reviewing it, but I believe that they will be. And I also know that there's some degree of timeliness to this, so I'm hoping that they can review it in the next couple of months. And I'm hoping that we can bring this agenda item back in January. I'll be making that request to the Senate President and to the Speaker. And I do believe, I don't know if the Speaker has done this yet, but I do anticipate that President and probably the Speaker will name most committees tomorrow or in the next few days. So the Judiciary Committee will probably be one that will be named, I would assume, and so that they can do this review. And I would hope that you would communicate your concerns to both chairs. But I think it's important we approve the first three portions of this and we put this on a reasonable time schedule to get it back to the subcommittee in January if the President and the Speaker concur with that. Are there any questions? Is there a motion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'll move the LFO recommendations as outlined.
The LFO recommendations have been removed. Are there any objections?
Mr. Chair, no. Yes. I'm going to be voting for this for the very reasons this committee was appointed to begin with. But I'm under no illusions. Senator Morse indicated that we're going to actually be able to catch someone like Mr. Boyles as a result of all this effort, and that I am still very concerned about you know, you have supervisory people for reasons and some accountability along those lines, or this is well-intentioned but perhaps not getting at the source of this particular issue.
Thank you. Hearing no objections, the motion passes. Senator Morse, given the fact that you are trying to get an OYA facility opened in Ashford, would you carry this?
Certainly.
We will move on to the next item, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And we have already lost the bet. Representative Morgan, I believe, has won. Her committee finished sometime ago.
She didn't do anything anyway. Mystery.
Well, she doesn't have me in her committee.
That's it.
That's the issue.
Marla, can we cut the...
Probably not, Senator. You're familiar with the term hell to pay?
Yeah. Well, Marla, how much time do you need to do it? Do it in 10 and do your agency portion and in another 5 to 10?
The look of incredulity is profound.
Okay. We'll give you five and ten. For the sake of the committee, this is an item that issues surrounding this will probably be coming back to us several times during the hour. Now, if your technology doesn't work, then you're in trouble. Okay. Mr. Campbell.
Mr. Devlin, Chair Devlin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm the Governor's Senior Policy Advisor and the State Homeland Security Advisor. I will let the members of the panel introduce themselves for the purposes of time. I also have some written information that, due to the crunch on time, I would encourage you to read, and I'll try and make my comments very brief. We're coming before you today with a recommendation that has two elements to it that were developed through both our State Interoperability Executive Council and a group of agency heads that have been trying to resolve our telecommunications issues for the state. We currently operate with 4 state systems that are located in transportation, corrections, forestry, and state police. Those systems are operating with technology that is 50 years old, and quite frankly, during any major sort of disaster such as an earthquake, those systems quite frankly would not hold up, as we saw with Katrina and Rita. The other element to this that we're going to be coming forward with you today to make a recommendation on is the inclusion in the Oregon Emergency Office of Emergency Management, a communications person that would have a dual role of communicating with the public to prepare them should a disaster occur, and also who could provide clear, consistent, and appropriate information through the media during times of major crisis. During recent crises, specifically the hurricanes Katrina and Rita, the bombings in London, and just last Wednesday, the false alarm on the tsunami, we had key emergency management folks who, instead of being able to do their job, were responding to media calls. And in one instance, we had, for instance, Ken Murphy during Katrina and Rita did upwards of 144 different interviews with the media. He actually tracked it. Now, we hire those folks to actually prepare and respond to emergencies. It is critical that we have someone who is in a position where they can provide good information to the media that the media will trust and relay so that we can prevent the loss of life through the conveyance of misinformation, and that is a critical part of this. It is not directly related to the development of the telecommunications infrastructure that we are putting before you as well. The FCC has set a deadline of January 1st, 2013 for us to have a telecommunications interoperable system in place. This is the first step, the planning step for that. I would say that while that is a reason for us to move forward, it is not the only reason. The main reason is because Oregon desperately needs to have a reliable statewide telecommunications system that allows first responders to be able to communicate with each other at any time, at any place throughout the state, not only at the state level, but also at the federal level and with our local partners, which, by the way, is the reason why Chief Johnson is here today. We wanted to come forward with a recommendation that reflected a tremendous amount of work in making sure that we weren't asking you for anything that we didn't believe we really needed. So this is a cut-down version, but it handles everything that we need to have happen in conjunction with an RFP we have just put out. I will comment that usually an RFP of this type takes 8 to 9 months to develop, and because of some extraordinary work by not only administrative services but a number of our key agencies involved, we were able to put that RFP together in 1 month. It went out and we got a tremendous amount of response, and hopefully we will have that put to bid within the next week or two. But in order for that to work successfully, these other positions have to be filled so that they can do their work, so that we can come before you with a business plan and with a recommended structure and engineering plan for the rollout of the system between now and 2013. With that, in the interest of time, I think I will turn it over now to Chief Johnson and allow him to speak on the next deal, unless any of you have any questions.
Thank you. Chief Johnson, I think it might help... Given your territory, and if you'd identify who you are, and you're the chief of the Tualatin Fire and Rescue, I can't. It's longer. I don't know. But how many different public safety entities are within your territory that you might have to communicate with?
Mr. Chair, members of the board, good morning. My name is Jeff Johnson. I am the fire chief at Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue. We serve 9 cities in 3 separate counties in the Portland metropolitan area. We serve a population of about 425,000 folks, and we are a regional emergency service provider that has been a byproduct of mergers and consolidations over the last 16 years. I am here today as a representative of the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association, and I am chair of Oregon's statewide interoperability council. To summarize what that is, in Oregon there are 4 states' separate radio systems, as Mr. Campbell has articulated. Underneath those 4 systems are a host of local government-operated radio systems, some of them run by counties, some of them by special districts, some by cities. It may surprise you, and it may not surprise you, that over the top of us today and all throughout Oregon are various layers of radio systems that you can't reach up and operate on. Quite simply, the SIEC's goal is to make those systems that are up there available to those emergency responders that need to talk. The systems developed in Oregon have been developed largely without regard to making sure that local providers, state providers, and all other responders, now thinking federally, can reach up and talk when you need to, and that you have access to a robust signal if it's over your head. Literally, to create roaming for public safety radios like we have on our telephones. The SIEC has adopted a strategic plan, and this request today is entirely consistent with that strategic plan. And unfortunately, while it is a part of it, it isn't entirely. There is a deadline at 2013 that the FCC has set, and much of our request has to do with meeting that objective by 2013 when the federal requirements take place. It is about emergency responders being able to talk when they need to, eliminating the duplication of local and state systems that are uncoordinated. I think it is entirely about good government. I think it is entirely about making sure we're making wise use of our money. And I apologize and appreciate and understand there's a sticker shock involved with this project. I am going to cut short my prepared remarks in deference to Mr. Fole, Mr. Chair, if that serves this committee's purpose, because I think the presentation he has will illuminate the comments you've heard today.
Thank you very much,
Chair.
Any questions for Mr. Johnson or Mr. Campbell at this point? Proceed. And I don't actually mean to cut you short. I'm just...
I know that you will be back again in a few months, so.
Yeah.
Have interoperability problems here?
If this were wireless, we wouldn't have the problem.
Well, he's preparing one of the comments. I think many of you have reviewed this. I've heard estimates of the total cost. This is your sticker shock. It's between $300 and $500 million over the course. So I think it's probably very important that we do this right from the beginning. So please proceed.
I'm Don Full. I'm a communications manager for the Oregon Department of State Police. I was thinking that this last September started my 41st year in public safety communications. I've had three employers over that period of time, roughly spaced about the same amount of time with each: City of San Francisco, the State of Oregon, and City of Mesa, Arizona. During that time, in the 60s, I was part of the communications group trying to support police and fire during the civil rioting and the bombings and the shootings and the SRA in San Francisco. I've been in the floods and the high winds, in the earthquakes, and consistent with all of that has always been that communications was never adequate, that communications, even operability for a department is poor, but interoperability has been non-existent. House Bill 2101, when the legislature passed that, said that we need to consolidate communications for state agencies. We have four different systems today. The departments, individual departments, including the military department, have been meeting every Thursday morning for about the last year and a half, trying to come up with a plan for what we need to do. All of those agencies have agreed that we need to consolidate into a single infrastructure that lets us be interoperable. That brought on OWIN, the Oregon Wireless Interoperability Network. Planning for the actual consolidation started with the passage of 2101, and OWIN will consolidate all of the state agencies onto a single system. For the first time, among state agencies, we will be fully interoperable. We will be able to communicate between state police and forestry and transportation and military and corrections across the state. Along with that, OWIN needs to take responsibility for the state's part of this interoperability solution. The SIC conducted a survey about a year ago, and one of the elements of that survey on behalf of local government said that if we are to have interoperability, either the state or the federal government is going to have to do it. That individually, local agencies simply cannot put together a cohesive system that will allow interoperability. There are six levels there. This is a classic kind of thing that's arisen in the last several years of how to achieve interoperability. And going from level one to level six, the higher the level, the more comprehensive is the interoperability. At the basic level is swapping radios, and this is typically done on interagency narcotics kinds of things where we will give radios to the FBI or they will give them to us, or DEA. We swap radios and are able to communicate. It's limited unit to unit, very short range. Moving all the way up to level six is where everybody is on a common system. And it follows, I think, Chief Johnson mentioned that there are various layers of radio systems, and that is a function of the availability of frequencies for public safety agencies to operate on. There are lots of those different frequency bands. And the truism is that a radio will only operate on one of them. There are no multi-band radios available today. There may be in the future, but there are none today. And so to have true interoperability, if you put everybody onto a single system, and if you base that system on standards so that there's open competition for purchase of equipment from lots of manufacturers, that's the best it gets. interoperability goals that that we've set are level six for state agencies. That is, all state agencies go onto a common system, and therefore they become interoperable. Also, any other users of that state radio system would become fully operable. Again, putting everybody onto a common system. We believe that the best fit for Oregon for all of interoperability for the state is level four. That may seem a little bit incongruous and say, why would we drop down on behalf of the state? Well, I did a data research from the SEC records a couple months ago, and I counted just slightly over 500 public safety agencies licensed with the SEC in the state of Oregon. Now, many of those are different departments of a county and so on, but there are lots and lots of agencies out there. There are lots of systems, and I think the ability to get everybody onto a single system is really zero. We can't get there. But what we can do is to take a look at the systems that exist out there and figure out a way to connect those systems together for interoperability. And by doing that, there is a huge investment in the metro area right now, three counties in Oregon, one in Washington, on a single level five system. All the equipment there is from one manufacturer. It's not built to standards, and it doesn't have open competition, but they're all on it. They have excellent interoperability within the metro district area. There's no reason to try to extend that metro solution throughout the state. It doesn't fit the rest of the state, nor does it make sense to try and impose a state solution on the metro area. So the trick then is to say the metro system is going to continue to exist. How do we connect to it for interoperability? This is a diagram of what the state agencies through the State Wireless Infrastructure Investment Group, all the state agencies came together to talk about how we get interoperability. This is the idea that we came up with, that the state, on behalf of the state, in order to meet the FCC mandates, we need to replace our radio system. We desperately need to replace the microwave system that connects all of these facilities together. We need to rebuild the infrastructure. That's the buildings and towers and security arrangements on those buildings. We need to rebuild that. So if the state does that on behalf of state government, then along with that, the microwave system will support a network which will then be the conduit for tying all of those individual systems together out there. You'll notice that one layer in this is the federal IWIN system. And we'll talk a little bit more about IWIN, but it is a consortium of law enforcement, federal law enforcement agencies that is starting to build a nationwide law enforcement system. There is a layer in there that is called interoperability channels, and it lists the various bands that we have to operate on within public safety. And what makes this solution unique in the whole country, that I don't know of anybody else that is saying that in order to make this work, we need to position that interoperability layer throughout the entire state. We need to give a metro radio the ability to go to Grants Pass on a wildfire and have an entryway into the network. And the only way to do that is through that interoperability layer. Lastly on the list there is a data network. Just before I came back to the state of Oregon, I put in my fifth generation of mobile data. Mobile data today, at least in law enforcement and gathering in fire services and EMS, is extremely a critical service. In today's day of interconnection to databases, to wants and warrants and all of those things, is just imperative. And today, the state has no data capability. Down at the bottom, you see that are the other systems that exist out there, the various systems, the metro, county, tribal, district. Those other 500 agencies that are out there with communication systems. And at their choice, at anybody's choice in this, they can connect to this network for interoperability. So it doesn't put a mandate on anybody. Why the virtual private network? Because it's secure. Many times when I talk about this, people say, oh, well, that's the Internet. I can sit at my desk and I can be connected into the radio system. No, that's not it. In order to be able to survive, in order to be able to be reliable in a time of emergency, it has to be a completely secure and private system that is well maintained, that is not subject to priorities of anybody else. It needs to be sized to handle all the day-to-day. More interoperability goes on day-to-day than will ever happen in emergencies, in cataclysm. Every day we are communicating on behalf of state police with county sheriffs, with city police departments. That happens every day. And the system has to support everything from the smallest to the largest. But public safety always has to have the priority. What does that network do? It can tie systems and equipment together. It can tie dispatch centers together. You could, through the network, you could have a dispatch center in Malheur County, which is able to communicate through the network directly with the state police dispatch in Central Point, for example. It can tie mobile and portable radios together using those interoperability channels. And it can tie mobile and portable radios into other systems. This is a picture that I wanted to show you. This is a state police has a radio in this building down near Springfield. And I put a little note on there about the tower. If we had anywhere near, we don't even have to have a Category 5 storm. If we had an 80-mile-an-hour storm, this building would be gone. The tower would be down. There would be nothing that would have survived. An example of a good one is a facility that we're putting together with Polk County up on Eagle Crest in the Ola Hills. This is the modern facility that you have in order to be able to survive the things that happen out there. This has its own generator system, a survivable building and a survivable tower. This is the only one that I know of in Western Oregon that meets the level that we need to be able to survive disasters and emergency. There are two others under construction now down in Lane County, and along with Iwin, we will be having about another 10 in Western Oregon. There are 8 that I know of in Eastern Oregon, and the only reason they're over there is because of the CSEP program in Umatilla and Morrow County. Guidelines, we need to put a digital system together. We need buildings that are sized to handle the federal, local, and state needs. We need to have security measures and environmental controls in those buildings. It has to be, in order to survive, in order to be reliable, we have to step up what we use to house this equipment. This is ODF has 55 sites throughout the state today, ODOT 96 sites, OSP 103 sites. We have 118 repeaters in those 103 sites. Composite, there are 171 state-owned sites. This, I just threw in to show you the complexity of the microwave system. It's not easy. It's not simple. This is a four-loop system for reliability. Consolidation is going to reduce those number of sites. When we get down to engineering the coverage that state agencies need and get rid of the overlaps that we built over the years of each agency building its own sites, we're going to have fewer sites. How many, I can't say. Also, changing to a different type of radio system will put control into the vehicle, into the system instead of the vehicle. And the example I use is you don't go around the state today with a cell phone dialing into the tower. The system takes care of where you are. These are some design goals. These are in your packet that you could read. the integrated wireless network, OSP and the state are in a partnership. We have an MOU with Federal Department of Justice. If you look at these two diagrams, you'll see Interstate 5 on a red line, and then see coming down the I-5 corridor is the IWIN system. That's a system that was started under a federal grant to connect the OSP Northern Dispatch Center to the Southern Dispatch Center. That is entirely being funded with federal funds, an original ODP grant, and almost $2.5 million in IWIN funds given to us to be able to improve the infrastructure to be able to supply service to them. The state portion of that is that we get two engineers for 24 months to be able to put the microwave in. We get a project manager for 12 months. In the end, the state owns all the buildings and all the microwave. The only thing IWIN owns is the radio system of its own that is in those buildings. We issued an RFP for consulting services, and again, you can read what the various elements of that are. Basically, what we need to do is we need to have a very good conceptual design, and I say we have to have a good conceptual design by January of 07 to come back to the legislature. It has to be good because the reliability of that is going to tell us what the final cost is going to be. And so that conceptual design has to be very accurate, or we're not going to know exactly what it's going to cost. Along with that, the state has involvement. One of the biggest problems, I think, this is my personal perspective, that the state has had is that we have not had over the years a professional engineering and planning organization for wireless communications. And we cannot just simply throw a contract out there and say design something without us being at least that smart to know if what we're looking at is true, if what we're looking at actually meets the needs of the state. And so that our involvement is to ramp up a small design team internally within the state to be able to work with the consultants to develop that plan with a high degree of reliability. These are the various positions that you see before you in the packet here. And that's my part. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Chair Devlin, members of the subcommittee, good morning. For the record, my name is Beverly Stillwell, and I'm the director of the Oregon Office of Homeland Security. You've heard quite a bit of testimony today from not only the governor's policy advisor, but also from our local partners about the need for having interoperable communications and the need for replacing at the first level the state system. I'm here before you today just to outline the specifics of what the emergency board request is to you today. And the specifics are for public safety wireless and infrastructure replacement. We did an original request to the committee of $763,000, and we were asking for five positions. We've done a tremendous amount of work with our agency partners that were indicated at the beginning of testimony with ODOT, Department of Forestry, Corrections, and the State Police, to be able to look internally as to what already existed that we might be able to transfer positions over to help. So in the light of that, we were able to reduce the request to this board to down to three positions, and that would fund a drafting technician that is necessary in order to put together all of the drafting for each of the sites, including tower specifications, the professional engineer services that Don Poole talked about that are lacking within the state system right now, to have the engineer in place to be able to work with the contracted consultant, and also an FCC, a Federal Communications Commission, license coordinator to coordinate the various FCC licenses that the state currently has, and there isn't a position that does that. What we're going to do is also look internally for office support and not request that from this body, is to look for the purchasing person that's necessary to help fulfill purchasing needs and also for doing correspondence. What that does is reduce our request of this body to three limited duration positions for a total of 2.29 FTE and down to $520,000, $850 in support of the wireless infrastructure plan. I'm also here today to request in support of a public information officer to work before, during, and after disasters to make sure that our communities are educated in what they need to do to prepare themselves and to make sure that there's a point of contact for all media to be able to call in and be able to get their questions answered too. That would be one limited duration position for the remainder of the biennia, 0.79 FTE equivalent of $130,570. I'm also requesting an increase in federal fund limitation for Oregon Emergency Management to accept in the federal funds for the IWIN project that Don described in working up and down the I-5 corridor in shoring up 12 of the existing OSP sites. And I'm requesting limitation of $2,495,432 for that project. And that concludes my testimony, and I would welcome any questions the members may have.
I actually had one question. The four positions that you've indicated, three plus one, I do anticipate that some of those positions would be people that would be probably brought from other agencies also. Do we have an idea how many of those people might be just totally new from out on the street, basically, that would have to be, you'd basically have to go through an extensive process to decide who to hire?
Mr. Chair, in my conversations with Don Full, he does not feel as though the engineer position, someone of that caliber, currently exists in state government, nor possibly the drafting technician to do the drafting plan. So those may be more extensive recruitments, the engineering position being the most difficult to recruit. That's why we've scheduled February 1st of 2006 as being the start date for this position, anticipating that we may have a recruiting window that we're going to have to work through. The FCC license coordinator is a position that should be more readily available through a recruitment process, and we shouldn't have difficulty in filling that.
Any questions?
Actually, I have a whole bunch of questions, yeah. Mr. Chair, but I'm not sure what when the appropriate time to ask them.
Okay. Representative Krupp, if you want to start.
Well, I'm sort of in Senator Schrader's mindset also, because we certainly have verbiage here from LFO in terms of their recommendations, and it begs some questions, and if you don't mind, I'll just dive into questions.
Okay. Why don't we, for the sake of getting everything out on the table first, why don't we get the ban and the LFO recommendation, and then we can tackle this thing straightforwardly. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the subcommittee, again, Linda Gilbert, DAS Budget and Management. What she said, we are recommending allocation of $651,420 from the State Emergency Fund for the four positions, limited duration positions, an increase of the federal funds expenditure limitation by $2,495,432, and again, establishment of four limited duration full-time positions totaling 3.08 full-time equivalent.
Mr. Wilson.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, I'll divide mine up into three portions here because there are really three parts. The first part is the easy part is the federal funds of just under $2.5 million. That is money that's coming in. It will offset the cost of the future systems costs that we've talked about here a bit, and we recommend approval of that federal funds expenditure limitation. The second one is the public information officer, PIO, that was briefly mentioned for Office of Emergency Management. This was a position that I understand was part of discussions during the development of the 05-07 budget, was not included in the governor's budget, and also was not included in the legislative budget. While we see the value of such a position, we are concerned a bit about sort of the size of the E fund and the potential demands and feel it's relatively early in the biennium or in the interim to start tapping the E-fund at that level, and also that this is something that the legislature or the governor did not approve for the budget originally. If other funds could be found for it, we would find it as very supportive, probably be supportive of it, even in the interim. The last one is the positions for basically what you saw as the bulk of the presentation. They're requesting, originally requested, I think, six positions. I have to go back and look. They have redone their recommendation to, I believe it's four positions, but I'm hearing three or four. I'm not sure which one from both DAS and the agency. Our approach is to say, number one, this has not had the level of review by, for lack of a better term, a policy committee of the legislature. In this case, the Joint Committee on Information Management and Technology. We would really think that that would be the next step. But at the same time, we don't want to slow down the process because the deadlines, the need for this, the condition of the existing system, the always the potential for a disaster. So in that case, in, with that in mind, our recommendation is to provide 3 months, what is essentially 3 months or through February, of funding for four positions at a total cost to the emergency fund of $174,496. That would take them through February 1st and have them give them enough time to go forward in front of the IMT committee, which I understand should be appointed in the next few days, hopefully, and we'll have a meeting before the January e-board, and they could come back to the January e-board and request the other funding. The other unknown is the original request was totally for emergency fund dollars. The total request was for almost $900,000 for the entire package. We feel that since DOT and forestry are generally other or federal funded agencies, that there are some contributions that could be made. They've already identified some, but the long-term commitments, even through the 0507 biennium, is still in question, and we feel that that needs to be settled before a final amount can be provided for the emergency fund. And for that reason, or for that being another reason, to only at this time recommend 3 months to keep the project, and it is an important project, moving.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative
Crowley. Beverly, clarify a couple of things for me first. How many positions are you now asking for? If it's not six, how many precisely is it? Bam, you guys want to clarify that for us, please?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kraft, what we're asking for are three positions in support of the wireless initiative, one position in support of the public information piece for four total positions.
Okay, and Mr. Chairman, if I may?
Yes.
Thank you. So you've been asking for $893,660 for four positions, or?
Between the two of them, yes. So I'm asking for $520,850 for the three positions in support of the wireless initiative, and I'm asking for $130,570 for the one position in support of public outreach, public information.
So that's 650, roughly somewhere in that range, compared to 8900. Okay. Mr. Chair, if I may, how difficult will it be if we adopt LFO's recommendation here of basically 3 months financing? How difficult is it going to be for you, and perhaps it's a more technical question for Don because he works in this area, to attract the kind of people you need to get us to the next phase here? How difficult is it going to be to do that if you got a three-month contract together with no guarantee that they're going to get more money down the road? Does that present a challenge, or is it going to be easy? Can you hire people tomorrow on that basis?
I think you're right on. It's going to be a tremendous challenge. If anything that you do, if you cut down the term or if you say limited duration, that is going to be extremely difficult to attract the people that we need. Because we don't have the luxury of bringing people on and having 2 years to train them. We need people who can come in and hit the ground running. And that's going to be extremely difficult to get people to come here to do that. And we just simply don't have the expertise ourselves.
And I would concur that even just having the limited duration on it as opposed to permanently funded is a detractor for potential candidates, but we have went forward requesting the limited duration positions for the remainder of the biennium.
Mr. Chairman, one more question.
Yes.
If there was enough funding here for your three most intensive positions, which would be your wireless positions, most critical in my mind, if there was enough funding there for 6 months, with the ability of the e-board to come back and grant additional funding, would that make it easier to attract the right kind of person as opposed to 3 months? I would say yes, it would make it easier.
Doesn't
mean you're going to get it done, but it
That's
would.
Correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes,
Senator. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Have we explored the possibility of finding contractors that would come and design the system as opposed to trying to do it in-house?
The RFP that we have under evaluation right now will do exactly that. It will be to hire a team of contractors to do the actual system design. So we are hiring engineers. They will. My guess is that we will have 6 to 8 engineers working on that for the next year in order to come back before the next legislative session with a solution. But we don't have the expertise in-house. These consultants will not operate in a vacuum. They need to operate off of what we tell them and what are our needs, and we have to have some control of that. So that's why we have to have some expertise in-house. We need to have our own engineering talent that knows what to say to them and knows where to put the control on.
Mr. Chair, and I'm not sure if that was entirely clear in the presentation, but and that RFP is being funded with Homeland or federal funds from Department of Homeland Security that are either in hand or will be from the allocation in the next federal fiscal year. So they have existing funds to fund that RFP or planned funds.
Senator Schrader, do you have questions?
Few, if I may, Mr. Chair. And the reason I have a few, and I apologize if you don't want me to go down the line of questioning, I'm okay with that, but it plays off of LFO's comment. There's really been not a lot of discussion about the substance of this whole project, and this is a huge project, potentially. I'm not in this for $500 million. I mean, I'll tell you up front. Why is that, Kurt? Don't you want to save Oregonians? You want Katrina there? You don't want Iraq? You know, you don't want some earthquake, the flood, you name it. I'm worried about that. But I'm more worried in our budget environment in this day and age with the day-to-day things, the things I know are going to happen, about kids getting a good education, seniors getting kicked out of nursing homes, and just our prisons, much less the catastrophe. So I don't want to, you know, indicate I'm not in favor of saving the state of Oregon should Armageddon come. I mean, I think that's a great thing. But my priority as state legislators deal with the day-to-day things. We can't even fund that. So I don't want anyone here to think I'm not in favor of a really well-thought-out proposal. And I think you've done an outstanding job, both of you guys. I really appreciate all the work you've done. But you know, to that end, I guess does the RFP include who's going to be responsible in terms of dollars and cents for this project? How much are the locals going to put in terms of the patch, the way I'm reading your presentation? What's the federal government's responsibility in terms of, is this part of the RFP? I'm unclear as to who's going to be responsible for whatever the ultimate cost might be.
Chair Devlin and Senator Schrader, there is a finance committee that currently is meeting. It includes LFO, NBAM, along with state representation and also local representation to look at financing that may come out of the engineering and design proposal, whether or not that price tag is $500 million or $300 million. And they're in their infancy right now. And That was what their task is to look at how can we finance this? How can we leverage federal funds that could be available to the state? How can we possibly get earmarks on federal legislation and get specific earmarks for the state? And how might we be able to use COPs to be able to finance part of it? I think the goal of the committee is to look at least half of it to be able to be financed through federal sources. And I would want to say, just for the record, that this system isn't in place just for the catastrophic event. It really is in place for the day-to-day operations of our public safety officials to ensure that they, when they go on the scene of an accident, whether it be a catastrophe or a day-to-day event, that they can talk to each other. So I think that, you know, we need to make sure that I don't want anyone to think that we're putting this system in place only for a catastrophic event. It truly is day-to-day operations. We have a very aged system that is in disrepair and at any point could fail, and that would just be catastrophic in itself if someone should lose their life over not being able to speak to each other.
Can I have a request? Just a request. I appreciate the information. That's a very good point. The last point you made, I think you should emphasize a lot, because I get obviously going down a different track, and that's a good comment. Could I request that finance committee complete its work by the same time, in other words, February 2007 or whenever it was? That would be very helpful, because I think whatever policy committee or budget committee is going to review that, they'd have all the information about, you know, what we want to do and what we can actually afford, who's willing to put, you know, skin in the game, if you will, to actually make that happen. Second question, just general, how many of the ODF, the ODOT, the IWIN, OSP towers have gone down, have got were knocked down in either the earthquakes or the floods or the high winds we've had?
I can say the most recent experience was January of last year, when we had some snow and ice here in Northwest Oregon. We lost 6 sites in Northwest Oregon out of that, including one primary site that serves Salem here. St. Helens was down, Astoria was down, and everything west of Portland out to Astoria was down, everything about 20 miles west of Portland.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. And also the commercial sites. I mean, one of the questions I the back of my mind is, geez, we have a lot of towers all over the bloody state at this point in time. And what's the cost benefit analysis of piggybacking on some of those towers? There's room on the towers for lots of things, as I understand. And I understand, you know, is there an advantage in dealing with some reciprocal relationships there?
There's an extremely large advantage, and we do that. Right now we have a site over near Warm Springs where we're putting the third cellular company onto an OSP tower. So we do that routinely. Even in the commercial world, because of the cost of these facilities, they now come to us looking for use of public facilities. So that's commonly done. We are on state leases on at least half a dozen U.S. cell towers. From the Dalles over to Arlington.
And there's remuneration going back and forth depending on whose tower we're using.
Yes, there is.
Or they're using ours.
Yes, there is.
Okay. Very good. What have the, if I may, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
What have the locals indicated? Well, I understand your comments. I appreciate your expertise. If possible, get everyone on one system. Probably too costly also. But, and you also were emphasized, seemed like to me, that, you know, we're not mandating anyone do anything. On the other hand, you know, if this is for the benefit of everybody, I as a state official that's going to be expected, I assume, to put some of our money into the game, I would expect that we would mandate that the locals at some level have to put some of their money and or operations in the game or help pay for the patch or however that's going to be approached. Chief Johnson, you have
Mr. Chair, Senator Schrader, our vision to date has been that the state makes a contribution in terms of building the infrastructure, that we seek federal funding in the construction of this, but that we also consider local users tapping into it. Now, if we do this the way we envision it, People will have a decision to make about whether they rebuild and update their existing system or whether they buy capacity on this system. We believe if properly constructed, it'll be cost advantageous for local users to buy capacity on this system and thereby creating a revenue stream. Based on our experience legislatively with encouraging dispatch consolidation, there's been a lot of resistance at the local level to any mandate that would require them to buy into a system they've yet to see. However, again, we believe if we do this right, there will be an incentive for them to join. And we believe, frankly, that systems that they've already built, engineered, and are operating, as Don mentioned, in the metropolitan area, that will actually be part of our system of systems. And the local contribution is they built it, they're operating it, and our system plugs into that and actually utilizes it as part of our system of system. So I guess what I'm saying is there's the opportunity for a direct contribution, and there's an opportunity, and in fact part of the plan, that we use systems that they already bought and paid for with local money.
I appreciate that. Now, your comments about the dispatch is very understandable. It's taken years, and it's only been because of financial burden they've actually acquiesced over time. But I guess I would urge a stronger stance. And if we're talking interoperability, if we're truly going to have a seamless system, and there are serious potential health, safety, and welfare issues, I'm not a big mandate person, but I think in this issue, you would mandate that the locals would pick up the patch or come up with some recommendations for the legislature to entertain, that they would pick up the patch, they would pick up this part, or they have a choice A or choice B, but in either case, they're limited to those two choices and going to put some money into the proposal, because I think that's the only way you get this thing done. And hopefully you'll be working with you as a great representative, understand the nuances and problems, but I think everyone has to put something into this game to even remotely have a chance of it succeeding in the end.
Chair Devlin, Senator Schrader, I think point well taken, and we'll certainly do our best to consider that and try to go that way. If I haven't articulated it before, I'll try to make it clear. We are counting on a substantial portion of local money to make this system operate. We've yet to define that because we're in the infancy of our finance committee working on it. We're trying to find ways to bring our partners to the table. However, it is our preferred method to incent them to do it as opposed to push them through the door. But we certainly probably share a vision that they be part of this economically. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Anything additional? I do have one possibility on the table, and that is Representative Krupp brought up the issue of 6 months, and I believe I talked to some people about that yesterday. About 3 months was a little bit too short in terms of being able to put everything together. Within that period of time, you could get that finance report back in February. You could come back, give a report to this committee in January, and then if you need additional funds beyond that, you think you would be probably in pretty good position, because the Information Technology Committee would have probably had a few times to meet prior to that. Just seems 3 months is a little bit short, but I'm willing to go with the will of the committee in either that recommendation or the LFO recommendation.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I want to concur with you, and for the following reasons. I'm very concerned that a three-month time period is not enough to attract the kind of people that we need. And I had some experience in dealing with the scenic issue during the session in terms of not having the expertise at DAS to know what the contractors and the consultants are throwing at them in terms of you got to buy this, you got to buy that. And I think they make, and it's the question I asked them yesterday. I said, why can't you? And Senator Morse, you're right on the same wavelength with me. It's why can't you just hire all consultants to do this stuff? Well, you got to have the technical, you got to have people inside the agency at least as smart as your consultants, which is the problem we have with scenic, which I'm worried about. Okay? And I understand you got to have people inside that agency who know what the consultants are spinning at them so that we don't get the wool pulled over our eyes. Nobody wants another DMV computer mess. And this is far beyond anything we've ever spent before, potentially, and I think they have to have. So I'm satisfied that they've got to have the expertise. At this point, I think 6 months is appropriate, and I'll share with you why, because we're going to seek federal funds, and I think it's great that we're
moving them in that direction to help pay for some of these positions. Can you get grants done and approved in the bureaucracy of the United States government in 3 months? Not likely. 6 months makes that a more logical, common sense time frame to go seek federal funding for the continuation of these positions. So I've had enough experience riding with OSP officers to know how antiquated the radio communications is, and it puts officers' lives at risk. I've seen it with my own eyes. I've worked in it as a firefighter for 12 years. I know how disconnected and disjointed we are in our ability to communicate. And you're right, Senator Schrader, it's not just the massive events that could potentially happen, the Hurricane Katrina's or the dirty bombs, that would throw us into total disarray. And my view is, as good as we are, we're not capable of handling those types of emergencies because our system is so antiquated and so disjointed. So I would say that I would like to see this committee approve a recommendation that would be for three positions, the three critical positions. I don't think we need the PIO yet. I don't think we're not far enough along. I think the critical work needs to be done. I think three positions ought to be approved for 6 months. Let them come back and report to us in 3 months. I think that's a fair idea. That gives them more time to figure out what they truly need and look for federal money to make that happen. I'd like to see this committee move in that direction.
Before we actually... That was not in the form of a motion, but before we go to a motion, I'd like to hear from some of the other committee members to see where they are, and then we'll go to a motion if they want to speak.
The eloquent nature of Representative Krupp's comments have made me a believer in the six-month vision.
Okay. Do you want to make your motion?
Mr. Chair, I would move that we amend the LFO recommendation to approve the three wireless limited-duration positions for a six-month time period, and at the same time, that would be the only recommendation to amend LFO's recommendation.
So this would not include the information, the public relations person at this point?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that is my my direction as
And I would assume that the agencies that are involved could probably work on getting some assistance in public affairs, too, if they needed it in that interim, because we have a lot of public affairs specialists in state government.
Or one from ODOT.
So.
And Mr. Chair, I'm not trying to make Ken Murphy's job harder with having to answer all the public information requests and so forth that he's had to in times past, but okay. I just don't think we're far enough along to warrant a PIO position at this time.
Okay, there's a motion on the floor. One thing I would like to state, though, is a couple of items. One is that I share some of Senator Schrader's concerns. I believe that the interoperability is very necessary, very important, but I'm also concerned that not only is there going to be communications for that state trooper out there, and I'm just picking state troopers, but that state trooper is out there. Because without a state trooper out there, the communications don't really make any difference in Malheur County. But the other thing is that I know a lot of state agencies and federal agencies and local agencies have cooperated in this, and I don't want the director to come to my office. But ODOT often gives, and they have already cooperated with us, and they're working on this, but they often give the excuse that they cannot use any of their funds for these kind of purposes. Well, they find ways to use them for a very good purpose, for their incident command purposes and all the work they do with problems that we have on freeways. I think they can be a little bit more creative and perhaps contribute a little bit more to this. So with that...
Can we have staff reiterate?
Yes, okay.
Mr. Chair, and I've done some quick calculations, and I would like the ability to, if it's all right with you, to review them with the agency in between today and tomorrow to make sure they're right. But this would then be an allocation from the general purpose E fund of $231,035, an increase of our three limited duration positions, 0.47 FTE,
And then also keep in mind there is the $2,495,432 increase in federal funds limitation for the federal IWIN project, which goes along with that.
And Mr. Chairman, how many dollars was that total then that we would do, just the rough?
$231,035. And I'd like a chance to review that with the agency. I think they'll agree with it or be very close to that.
I think that's important. So that's actually clarifying the motion that's on the table. Are there any objections to the motion? Hearing none, the motion passes. Since I've not assigned anything to you, Representative Krupp, would you like to carry this?
I'd be honored. Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming. This concludes our work today for this subcommittee, and we'll see you all in January.